Evening, everyone.
Good evening.
All right, we will begin with the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Someday. Okay, may we have the roll call, please?
Good evening. I'd like to give the roll call. Chair Hartwig.
Present.
Vice Chair Hurd.
Present.
Commissioner Castillo.
Present.
Commissioner Griggs Murphy.
Present.
Commissioner Montgomery.
Present.
And Commissioner Zhang Li.
Present.
Thank you.
Okay, do we have a motion to approve the minutes from the special meeting of April 4?
I'll make that motion.
A second.
Been moved, seconded. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Abstentions? Good. Carries unanimously. Old or unfinished business?
There is none.
There is none. Are there any modifications to the agenda? Hearing none, we will then move on to new business. Item A, our budget workshop.
Good evening, commissioners. Tonight we are just talking about the budget, so there's no action before us, but we have presentations from different departments highlighting some of the things that we're doing this year. It's an interesting budget in that I think we, for the first time, list all of our projects at the end. You'll see where that means all the things that we plan money for in development, because I want to have the commitment from OHA for those projects so that we can tell HUD it's committed by the board in the budget. So it's going to be, when we get to the end of the budget, we'll do it similarly, same way we've done it in other years. We'll have different departments give presentations, and then Tracy will go over the budget worksheets. As you know, we replaced the year-over-year variances in the previous year. 2016 had some inaccuracies we discovered late last week, and Tracy was able to reconcile it over the weekend. So we have the new variance report. It should be on your desks that you will use for that discussion. And I guess we'll move on. I'm going to try and actually – oh, you did it. Thank you. We got the PowerPoint on. So the first topics we're going to do is we're going to do departmental overviews, so you can understand some of the things that we're proposing this year that maybe is a little different than what we've done in the past, and some mild reorganizations of some departments with different focuses and staffing changes. One is in leased housing. Leased housing is, you know, we have a large challenge with not only leasing up in the current rental market, but we're actually doing some new programs and initiatives for landlord incentives and things. So Michelle Son's going to be up here with Andres Manriquez to talk about that. And then Anita will be up with Family and Community Partnerships talking about some changes and some of the different focuses that we're going to do, and adding some oomph to, I think, what we've been doing, particularly around resident employment. Chief Duplessis will be up talking about the police department, particularly some initiatives around body cameras that we have approved, but we're going to be coming forward and implementing in the next year. I want him to talk about it. And then we'll go over our capital improvements list, and that means the projects that we're going to put under construction, mostly police account. And that'll be both William Bailey, Mark Schifferl, and Anna Kadanovskaya, who all work together on these projects, and includes also the budgeting for the major rehabilitation of the Oak Groves North and South, which is $60 million. And Office of Real Estate Development is going to talk about the real estate projects that we have been in discussions with that you're aware of, and just show you where they're budgeted and the timeline. In the last one, you'll realize we may not expend the money that we have in the budget in this fiscal year. And if we don't, we will move it to the next fiscal year until we complete the project. But we want to make sure we have the placeholder and we have the money behind any commitments the board's going to make. So we're revising some of the ways we do that. And then following all that is Tracy will be up, and she will give the overview of the year over year, but also the large table that shows our different operating divisions and the money and how it flows, and also how we calculate indirect cost rate, one of the most complicated things in the world. So we're going to sit through another presentation of buckets, because it's always helpful for me, and I hope the board to know how that works. A couple of the highlights. One is the MTW agreement extension, continuing our current formulas. At your next meeting in May, you will actually have an item approving The Secretary's offered to extend our agreement by 10 years. I want to do an extension for this because I want the board to approve it because you cannot make unilateral changes to the agreement. Although we have a letter that unilaterally approves our 10-year extension, I don't believe they have the authority to do that, and we need to take action and then inform HUD that we accept it. So that'll be in May, but it does allow us to start really implementing some of the things we've talked about over the past year and a half while we've been waiting for the extension. It's, I think, a terrific accomplishment that we were able to secure the extension, and I'm grateful to HUD for it. We have new funding commitments for local programs and landlord incentives. I mentioned the local programs are ones that we currently do, like sponsor-based, which we're planning on expanding the funding, not necessarily the number of participants, but we now have a path for them to get a Section 8 voucher, which allows room for new participants. The other ones are the ones we've been talking with the Special Needs Committee, and at the end of this month, there will be another item on the board that has been moved out of the committee to approve an MOU with Alameda County Social Services, which will, I think, dramatically enhance the results of families who are being assisted through the county in partnership with us, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And then we have to get busy and implement our West Oakland Jobs Plus initiative. So that's the $2.7 million jobs training grant, and it's headed up with Family and Community Partnerships, and they're trying to get it off the ground and the collaborative going, and we'll have a visit by HUD next three weeks, I'm not sure, a site visit, making sure we're doing things right. And can you hear me, by the way?
Pull it closer, just a little closer.
That's what I'm getting the signal. Now can you hear me? Okay. No point in me going on if people don't hear me. Thank you. So, and then we'll have the Jobs Plus. We've got to get our collaborative going, and we have to actually get it implemented. We're supposed to start July 1st. We've actually begun by getting the contract with the PIC in place. They're starting to do their coordination, and we want to do our kickoff event and really start the activities with a bit of a bang. So that, I think. Oh, and then I want to just talk about one other slide that's assigned me to talk about, which is the number of families and units and vouchers available. So I want to walk through, this is what we need to, these are the families served discussion we've had in the past, and I just want to show you where we currently, what our agreements currently say in the baseline. So the Housing Choice vouchers, we have 12,858 families that we want to serve. We're under-leased in that regard. We want to try and get our lease up higher. Public housing, we have 1,606 public housing units. Of those public housing units, they are included some in our mixed finance developments. So they take a chunk away. And then our seniors are 383. And then our family are Lockwood, Peralta, and Campbell. And of those three, it's about 750 or so. Then we have local non-traditional. So we have low-income housing tax credit units that are not assisted by Section 8 or public housing, so they're otherwise unassisted, 846. Sponsor-based housing assistance program at 130, that's the Oakland's Path 3 housing initiative. We last year budgeted at $1.5 million, but we're going to increase it to serve 125 people this year, which matches the city's money. Local housing assistance and MOMS, those are smaller programs that count toward families served, and it's 1,012 through that. We have non-MTW. Non-MTW, what we mean are these are programs that are traditional programs funded by HUD that are not subject to our MTW agreement. So these are just boutique programs is what they used to call them, but VASHA's veterans, MOD rehab, mainstreaming, family unification, non-elderly disabled, and Shelter Plus Care are all programs and families we serve, but they don't impact our MTW agreement. They stand outside it. The one thing I would say is we were able to get some permission from HUD to project base using our MTW authorities, particularly for VASH. So you're going to see about six proposals. I think it's six, right? Six project-based awards in May, which include award of VASH vouchers, which I'm very excited about because we've been very underutilized in our VASH vouchers, been very hard, as some of you know, because I talked to a couple of you, I think, about it over the past year. It's been a real challenge with HUD. It's been a real challenge for our veterans. Having hard contracted units, I think, is really going to help with that one. So I'm excited about the idea of getting these under contract and hopefully in service as soon as possible so that our veteran searching can have more success than they currently have. And
so,
now
so
I'm.
Eric, I'm just curious. So if I add all of those totals together there on that slide, the 14, the 1,000, and the other 1,000, and I come up with about 16,000, that's actually.
That's who we serve.
The universe. Served or that we are capable of serving
absolutely
right
and
now right
yeah that's what we're getting. Those are the people that we are empowered to serve, and the only time, the only places we're short is if we don't hit our lease up in the Section 8 department.
Right
And so you'll hear me sometimes say we have 15,000 families or we have 16,500. The difference is if you're counting are non-MTW or if I'm just counting MTW.
Yes,
so
yes.
If you hear me throw both those numbers out, it's because sometimes I'm just referring to our MTW families, which is that first MTW column, and sometimes I throw in the additional, 1,200.
Now, in terms of VASH, what percent utilization do we have right now?
It's dismal.
Okay, that's all I wanted to know. That's fine.
No, I would tell you, it's we have been in conversations with HUD now for 2.5-3 years. They had awarded us 61 vouchers when we still had 100 left on the old award. We wrote them a letter saying we didn't want the vouchers and please give them to someone who could use them. They had a huge crisis occur because of my letter. And I said, okay, we're going to take them, but if we can't use them, I'm going to send them back because I don't want them to be left unused. If there's jurisdictions in this area or in this county, it's been a challenge. So,
and we have structural impediments to utilizing those vouchers.
There's a huge disconnect in the way that HUD perceives the Bay Area. And I actually was in D.C. at one time a year ago, and I took a map that we had developed, and I went and met with the head of the BASH programs in HUD to explain to them how they're not understanding the data that is having them award vouchers. One of the jurisdictions that was receiving no VASH vouchers is Contra Costa County, which is currently housing something like 60% of the VASH participants in the East Bay. They didn't realize the geographical issues. And the reason was, in Martinez is where the VA hospital is.
Yeah.
And so they're staying near the hospital. So I had this whole thing showing the different VA hospitals and who was underleased and who had no vouchers and how they were giving the wrong agencies the vouchers and requiring people to go through these searches inside their jurisdictions and all these problems. It fell on deaf ears, as one might imagine, because they thought other places are not having those challenges. And so they didn't really do anything. We were offered another 30 or so. We have yet to even – so I didn't respond because if they can realign them to another, to Contra Costa, or, that would be good. They give it to Pittsburgh. At the time, 100% of the VASH vouchers who were given to Pittsburgh were on port to Contra Costa County. Why were they giving Pittsburgh, this little city, this burden? Just give it to Contra Costa County. Anyway, so that's where we are. And how many, we have a total of 326 currently awarded. We have 264, which is a lot higher than it was a year ago, I would say.
Yeah.
So, Michelle's team have been hammering it, along with the VA. And what really happened is when the rental market was low and we could have actually found housing for the veterans, we had no referrals from the VA. So then the market got really hot, and suddenly the VA started giving us referrals, and people were out searching, and they're just searching, and we're extending it for 6 months. Yeah, and they're just not finding places. So that's been the disconnect. So we wrote to HUD in December, and we just got approval last month to include it in our MPW's authorities for VASH vouchers. So it was just in time for the city NOFA, so we entertained requests for VASH vouchers. And the developers of these properties like the VASH because it comes with services. So they get the built-in services, so now they're going to go for the 9% route, which is why they want us to quickly award these, by the way. And they can go with the services for the VASH included in their 9% tax credit application. So they may be very successful, is I guess what I'm saying, particularly in light of that cap and trade is the only money and redevelopment's gone. So they may do very well between Section 8 and the services from the VA to get these properties funded.
So in order for someone to be able to use a VASH voucher, they have to be recommended or
they go through the VA and the VA refers them to us. And one of the challenges we've even had in the past, we would identify who we thought were eligible participants under the VASH and refer them to the VA, and they would determine them not to be eligible.
Oh, wow.
We even had them cut subsidy on someone after they had been housed for 2 years. And Michelle and I literally scoured the CFR to see what we could come up with HUD support, but not the VA support, I might add. And we were able to find his name on the mainstream list and get an exception to move him to the mainstream program. Had he not applied, we would not have been able to do anything. So it's been a challenging program, and it's an important program. But I would say they also, in terms of the census data from the last homeless count, have made a significant impact in the number of veterans that are homeless. I think the next push from HUD we'll start seeing is going to be homeless children. So in the next year, I'd expect them to release designated funding like these special program vouchers that will really focus on homeless children. And when we get to Michelle's presentation, she talks about our partnership with Alameda County Social Services. The population that we're talking about with the CalWORKs is young mothers with children who are going from homelessness to housing, and we're trying to stabilize them permanently. And that's so we're already ahead of where I think the administration wants to go and HUD wants to go in terms of the next population that we can really focus on beyond maintaining the veterans.
So the ability to really fix the issues with the VASH program, that then lies largely, it sounds like, within the VA itself, right?
Say that one more time in the mic.
Within the VA itself. In other words, the issues in terms of really being able to be effective in the VASH program is really, because I mean,
it veterans, is. And they're,
I mean,
they're,
I'm just looking at that number of 326, thinking to myself, we got to have more veterans that have trouble than that in this city.
Keep in mind that veterans, before we even froze the 2013 wait list, we pulled every veteran off our wait list because they go to the top.
I see.
They're the top of all our wait lists, so they're already moving up. They have the first preference. So this is really for chronically homeless veterans, and it comes through the VA, and the VA is supposed to provide wraparound services for the veterans to ensure their housing success. Different population than just saying veterans going to the top of a normal wait list. These are really trying to address the chronically homeless individuals who really need services, and the VA is supposed to provide those services and case management. During the low referral times, they did not have adequate case management to maintain the caseload. That's why we were not getting referrals.
Got it.
All right.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you for this conversation. I was curious. I just have three questions. The Presidio in San Francisco, because of that big entity, how is the San Francisco VASH program doing?
You know, I honestly don't know. We have been so troubled with our own that I have never, I would have to... Do you know? I know they project-based.
They project-based.
Yes, I think they've done a lot of project-basing. My partners serves as a general counsel for San Francisco, and when she was on vacation, I went to one of the meetings, and that's what they were finding, that project-basing was the way to make it work. And they were doing a really large project. Wasn't at the Presidio. It was somewhere, I would say, like in the Tenderloin or near there. But it seemed to be, they figured that was the better way to do it rather than having people searching on their own.
I'm curious just to see if they're utilizing their vouchers.
I can ask and let you know.
Okay, thank you, Director. Yeah. The other thing is, how are we connected to Operation Dignity and Swords for Plowshares? Because a lot of veterans run through their organizations.
What a good segue to have Michelle Hassan come up with Andres Manriquez and talk to us about that.
Good evening, Commissioners. It's a pleasure to be here with you tonight. Andres Manriquez, Chief Operating Officer. I'm going to turn it over to Michelle. And
good evening, Commissioners. Michelle Hassan, the Director of Leased Housing. Commissioner Castilla, I will get to the answer to your question, but we are familiar with both of those programs and do partner with them. So this evening, I am going to focus on a couple of areas, specifically the Leased Housing Department reorganization. Eric talked a little bit about the families currently served. We'll look at our utilization goals for 2017. I'll share with you some of our leasing challenges and some very exciting solutions that the Housing Authority is moving forward with. So the department structure, as you know, our Chief Operating Officer, Mr. Manriquez, I have recently received approval to fill my second assistant director position, so we're very excited about that, and we are currently looking at changing the department flow and the team structure. One area that I'd like to draw attention to is the development of a program compliance team. We think that that team has been, will be able to address areas within the department that currently I would say are lacking. The focus of that team will be to really work with some of our families who have challenges or are at risk of losing their voucher. We get a number of police reports, inquiries from the public regarding families who are reportedly not being good neighbors. We have worked closely with our police department, but I think last year we fell short in focusing on some families that we could have intervened with. So this team is going to work closely with Chief's team in terms of vetting those police reports, meeting with those families, seeing if we can refer them for services, if there's an area that they might be able to maintain their housing, but ultimately, if necessary, take them to a proposed termination when we see that the family's not committed to their program obligations. So this team, again, will be focused on that effort.
And just to be clear, can you tell us what you mean by program obligations?
So every Section 8, every program participant has family obligations that they agree to when they receive the voucher. Some of those obligations are things such as paying their rent on time, not allowing people to live in the unit who are not on the voucher, not having drug or criminal-related activity while they are tenants, making sure that they notice us before they move from the unit, signing all the required documents that we need to have to fulfill audit purposes, reporting changes to income and household composition. So those are a few of the ones that the families agree to when they come on the program, and then they actually annually or triannually go back and sign that form that they acknowledge and understand those obligations. So when we say program compliance, that's what we're talking about. HUD basically states that families have to have repeated and serious violations of the lease. And so we have landlords who may report a lease violation, but we need to track to make sure that those violations are repeated and serious. And OHAPD provides support to us in trying to track those contacts that we have. So that's what that team is going to be focused on in the department, and I'm very excited about setting that up and getting that moving forward.
Now, Michelle, when you're talking about program compliance, does that also have behavioral guidelines in it that are part of the lease?
Well, remember, the Housing Authority is not a party to the lease. So if the lease is between the landlord,
I should say, to receiving the voucher.
Behavioral issues are not something that the Housing Authority necessarily vet, except when they become an issue around tenancy, neighbors, reports of issues that the landlord's seeing at the unit. But we, these individuals have leases like any other tenant, so they have a right to privacy. The behavior becomes an issue when it's serious and repeated. So it's not a problem so much that someone may be visiting a tenant because they have a right to have visitors, but if the landlord's reporting that they believe that there's someone living in the unit, and then we have proof that that person's living in the unit, usually by a vehicle's there every night, they're getting mail there, there are ways that we can investigate that to see if, in fact, what we believe is true can be supported. But there is a high bar for us to be able to terminate a family because of behavior.
Okay, because, well, the reason I'm asking the questions is sometimes landlords maybe just, they're very difficult to get a hold of. You get some of these absentee people, I don't know where they are. They're just very, very hard to contact. And there are instances with tenants that their behavior goes into the category that could only be described as horrific. Mm-hmm. I mean, like literally terrifying to the entire neighborhood. And so, and this has happened like several times in our neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I mean, really just, I mean, to the point of, I mean, we had a person recently, part of one of these groups that's now in jail for murder, and it turns out that he's accused now of being an assassin. So you just pay the guy $5,000 and then he'll go out and hunt somebody down and kill him.
So what we would be looking for, we cannot solely use hearsay as evidence to terminate a family. Even if that hearsay comes from a number of different sources, mm-hmm. we would have to have something in writing. We would have to have documentation showing that, in fact, there's been an arrest or a conviction. We would need someone to come and testify to what is being...
This is the problem right there. You got me, people in the neighborhood are terrified of testifying. And the typical situation that I've seen with this, these people are very clever, and you're not going to get them one, and you're not going to bust them.
So sometimes what we can use, however, are the documentation that we have. Chief's team is very good at following up, providing a paper trail, if you were, and we tend to bring the family in and let them know what we know or what we suspect and ask them about the behavior and expect them to change the behavior if it's happening. And usually what happens, Commissioner Hartwig, is that there's a trail of behavior that kind of, it never stops, it just escalates.
Right.
So we do, it does sometimes take time to build the case, but when we see that we've made an effort, we've brought the family in, we see that the behavior's not changing, then we can move forward. Remember, it's just a proposed termination. So we're proposing something. The family has the right to come in and testify or bring support to state that either they're not the one, which is what we hear, that it's a mistaken identity. But we also bring our police officer in. And many times owners are now feeling more comfortable to come in and testify. So the team will focus on that area.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So again, that's an exciting change in the department that we're very interested in setting up and moving forward, partnering with OHAPD and FCP. Eric talked about the allocation of our families, and these are the numbers in terms of the families that are actually served as of April. So out of 12,858 vouchers, we have 11,887 families, which is just at around 92%. You'll see VASH, which is, I think the number is around 80%, and then Mainstream. So there are vouchers that still need to be leased in all of these programs.
And that's also really important to remember as we come forward with our innovative housing solutions and local programs, because the funding we're going to use for the local programs is HAP funds. And rather than serve them through the traditional Section 8 program, we're going to serve them through our local programs and try not to leave any of the vouchers on the table so we can assist families.
So our goals for fiscal year 2017 are to maximize housing choice voucher HAP expenditures. As you can see, I didn't say utilize them at 100% because what we know is that our HAP dollars costs are going to increase because of the increase in the FMR, and so owners are asking for higher rents, so the HAP dollars are going to cover higher rents for all of our contracts. Our goal is to utilize up to 96 to 97% of our total voucher allocation. We also have a goal of leasing 100% of our special purpose vouchers, which are our VASH, FUP, and Mainstream. And we'll talk a little later in the presentation about how we're going to do that. Eric mentioned we do have authorization to PVV VASH. We're very excited about that. We do have 74 VASH vouchers that are currently searching on the street, and we think that one of our local programs will also assist with that program. Again, another goal is to increase the number of families served through our MTW local housing assistance programs, which I'll speak to later in the presentation.
So Michelle, the just to make sure I understand, the reason that our MTW goal is 96% instead of 100% is largely driven by the rent levels in Oakland, right, and the fact that it's more expensive.
Yeah, a lack of utilization. We have vouchers of people out searching who can't find it, and I don't expect that to change in the next year. So we've developed local programs, including an RFQ for project based assistance, including an RFQ for looking for some assistance for SRO units that will be out in the next month that we will then come to the board for approval of those project based awards. And that's the local program number that you're seeing.
Right, okay.
So what are our leasing challenges? Recently in Forbes Business, April 27th edition, they ranked Oakland as the second worst rental market in the nation behind Manhattan.
And ahead of San Francisco by one.
So while we like to be first on lists, this is probably not the one that is a good one. But again, with challenges comes, there are solutions. And we do have a vacancy rate currently that is at 2.8%. And that it does account for a little larger region than just Oakland. I think it does go into San Leandro and some of Alameda County.
You know, it's important to note on the top five worst rental markets, three of them were in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
It was New York, Oakland, San Jose, or San Francisco and San Jose.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Boston, believe it or not, Boston was.
But yeah, not Berkeley.
No, I don't think they're big enough to be metropolitan.
Oh,
area.
I see, right. Mm-hmm.
Again, one of the other challenges is a decrease in owner participation, and really as a result of the market. Owners are able to get much higher rents in non-Section 8 outside of the program, and so that just means we need to change our approach. So again, that becomes an opportunity. Our tenants have barriers to leasing, credit issues, fees for screening, and security deposits.
What are the fees? I mean, what are typically fees for
$25
screening? Oh, okay.
That's what I thought. Report.
Okay, right.
So they're paying multiple for credits and screening. There are application fees.
Right, because you might have to do 10 of those.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And families have limited resources. So mm-hmm. you may have a family that searches for one unit a month because they can afford to put one application in a month.
Yes,
they wait
right.
till they get their
right.
maybe their
right.
monthly benefits, and then I that's what I'm hearing when I'm speaking to families.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of our solutions? And this is the exciting part. So, of course, we had HUD raise the FMRs in 2016 about 34%. We expect that in October, which is when the FMRs are increased, that they will increase them again. I think they heard us in the Bay Area that they need to change the methodology and look at this market differently than other markets in the U.S. So we're hopeful about that. But I think the increase is really turned our owners' idea about what benefit the program can be for them. We have had more move-in requests and more rent increase requests probably in the last quarter than most of the end of 2015, the last couple of months of 2015. As you know, we are have requested HUD approval for landlord incentives, and we've budgeted for those in this 2017 budget. Some of those incentives are a bonus to lease a unit under the Section 8 program when a Section 8 tenant vacates a unit. A bonus may be up to $500 to $1,000. A vacancy loss. This is a program that is used now in the PVV and the Shelter Plus Care programs. What it would provide is a landlord 2 months of vacancy loss. And usually what owners are doing at that time are kind of turning the unit. So it will allow that as long as they lease to a Section 8 family at the end of that vacancy. Another incentive program is a capital improvement where a landlord who may be moving towards abatement, which is when they haven't repaired the unit and the tenant now is going to have to find another place to live, we could offer an incentive of a loan, if you will, to get some of those repairs done so the tenant does not have to move and the unit can meet HQS. What the housing authority would then do is have the landlord pay that back in their first two or three half checks. So, you know, we have seen an increase where owners are not, we believe, purposefully not doing repairs because they know we are going to cancel the contract. And so we're finding, we're trying to find solutions to what we see. And we think that that could be one, especially for our mom and pops who really don't have the resources when we tell them that you need to change, you know, out your windows or you need to change an appliance. It can be cost prohibitive for them. So those are some of the solutions. A very exciting solution that the Housing Authority under the leadership of Eric Johnson, we have are trying to leverage resources with our community partners, specifically Alameda County and some of our nonprofits. And the members of the Special Needs Committee that are here today have really worked hard to find areas that we can assist families that are in place, also to help families that may otherwise be homeless. And so we have focused on two groups in 2017 to assist. The first group is THP plus foster youth. THP is the transitional housing program. And these are foster youth who have, you know, up to the age of 18, they get assistance through the foster program, sometimes to 19. But after that, the assistance is provided to them for, I think, a period of 2 years. The Housing Authority would like to step in and assist these foster youth with stabilizing their housing with a shallow subsidy. So we would step down a subsidy for an additional 3 years, so a total of 5 years of housing subsidy to help them finish their goals. It might be education, it might be getting a job, and look at, again, helping once the subsidy ends through the county program.
And a shallow subsidy, when we use that word, just I like to make sure we all know the word because we make up these words. Shallow subsidy is when it's not calculated on your income. So it's not 30% of your rent. It's a fixed figure we're talking about. This will be a local program. It won't result in a project-based Section 8 calculation. It's really just trying to transition emancipated foster youth through school and onto their lives. And
so it's like a bridge for them.
Yeah, exactly. And it'll be a fixed amount. And we're in discussions about how much, and it'll go on for a period of time, then it will phase down to no subsidy over 3 years.
So again...
And these are pilot programs, by the way, under MTW. So we will study them after a few years and see what we need to change and what worked.
The other pilot program, local program, will be focusing on CalWORKS families. These families are formerly homeless. They're in the CalWORKS program with Alameda County Social Services. And the families have a plan, if you will, that they need to focus on for a period of generally 4 months. And so they're doing educational goals, their employment goals, but the county assistance ends at 4 months. And the Housing Authority, in conversation with the county, wants to preserve that family's housing because after 4 months, they're now looking to figure out how they're going to continue to stay in place. And what we would do is for those families who are compliant with their CalWORKS program, have met the goals and achieved the benchmarks as set by the county, we would then refer them to the Housing Choice Voucher Program. They would still have to go through eligibility screening, and the unit would have to meet HQS. And the goal would be that we assist that family that is in place. And again, they would not be homeless. So again, the county estimates about 40 families come through a month, but really only about 10 a month really get to the point where they can transition through the 4-month period. So we expect about 100 families a year would come through this CalWORKS program.
And would there be some, because with the housing choice vouchers, there's a considerable wait list to just to get those. So is there, are these people going to have a preferential?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. The goal, if you look at both of these groups, one of the goals that we set were to, and many of these solutions are around helping families that are in place, families that don't have to search for units in the community.
Yeah.
So we're preserving a unit, affordable, as well as assisting a family that's already housed.
Yes, good.
The other solution, again, that through Eric's vision, is to project-based vouchers, our own vouchers. Normally, vouchers get a PVV award through the City of Oakland, NOFA, and that is traditionally how projects receive project-based vouchers. But we are actually going to put out our own request for quotes, and we will be focusing on two particular areas. The first RFQ will be for existing housing units. The minimum would be a 10-unit non-contiguous site. So you could have 10 single-family homes. You could have a 6-unit building and a 4-unit building. But the minimum for the HAP contract would be 10 units. These units would have to meet HQS. We would probably do a pre-inspection just to see if the units have the ability to meet HQS. The families that are living in those units would have the ability to be screened for HCV. If in fact they did not qualify for HCV, we would just leave that unit off the HAP contract until such time that family vacated. So we wouldn't put that family at risk, but we could serve families that are already in place. This RFQ would be in a 2-stage request. So we'll put it out for 30 days, see what interest there is, and then we will open it again for an additional 30 days. We think what will happen is initially people will try to figure out what we're doing, and then we can vet questions, we can help them understand what our goals are. And we think in the second 30-day offering, we will get more interest. Our goal is we expect to project-based up to 500 units. So that
per
gap.
Year?
No, just total.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, just total. So that gap that we see around 500 at between 92 and 96, we think that some of these units will fulfill that. We might get 100 in 1 year and another 100 in the second year. But we think it's a way to get hard units and preserve them and help families that are already living in units.
And the idea of vouchering in place is one of the motivating factors, because you project base, the existing families, if they're eligible for our program, can come in and apply. And I think when we bring it, and we talk about it more as an item, but I think that's a huge opportunity for us in preserving families in Oakland. And I think we have a lot of families who are severely rent burdened. And I think this could actually address some of the displacement that's been going on.
So we would target buildings where we thought there was.
We're not targeting
population.
People, any landlords can apply. We'll have to respond to the RFQ.
I see. Okay.
And it can be nonprofit. It can be for profit. Okay. It can be single family homes. The one we are require, and it can be non-contiguous sites. So it doesn't have to be one property. So if you have 20 single family homes or 100. They can do one application, we do one award. That makes it easier for Michelle and her staff, but it also makes it easier for the property owner. And then if you're not eligible, then you stay where you are, and when the unit becomes vacant, just like it does on a project base, that's when they would come request that it be project based.
We also have some existing PVV projects that already have our awards, and they could come back and get more units, request more units in existing projects that you already have approved.
On the thresholds. And we think we'll get a number of those. And if you and you may remember, we have a property that called Foothill Family. And Foothill Family is across from Eastside. It's a nice, long, one-block, narrow property. But it was having real operational deficits. It's really managed it was managed by one company. We brought in John Stewart, who really helped address it. And if you're on that board, as the chair is, you went through this where it wouldn't cash flow. And if you remember, we came back to OHA to get 21 more vouchers there because it was the only way that property was going to be sustained. There are other properties in Oakland in the similar situation.
That are just like that. Yeah.
So I have a quick question. Like a tax credit property where a lot of the units are going unrented because of the affordability. If they did an RFQ.
That's exactly the audience.
Those are the kind of audience.
Yeah,
exactly. Because a lot of those buildings.
What happened at Foothill, and probably properties you're talking about, is that the tax credit rent was higher than the market rent.
Right.
And so they weren't able to lease them.
Right. But then I was concerned about also, you said, if there's already someone in that unit and they don't qualify for any assistance, but that unit would still be able to stay as a...
There's no displacement allowed, okay. It's not going to be something we'll entertain.
Okay.
Yeah.
How could tax credit rent in this market?
In this market, that maybe isn't the case.
Yeah, okay.
It would depend on the neighborhood and conditions and whether families turn over. But in the long run, over the compliance period, they may be right back there again.
Yeah.
So the second project-based voucher program that we will be issuing is a local SRO housing assistance program. So don't think voucher. This is not a voucher. This is a, as you know, there are many SRO buildings in Oakland. Many of them are in downtown Oakland. We think that preserving those units as affordable would benefit families to be able to stay in downtown Oakland. The key to the SRO housing assistance program is that they must come with services, supportive services. So what we envision is that many already have supportive services. Just recently, I visited the Aztec Hotel. Commissioner Castillo, Operation Dignity runs that hotel. And it is an SRO, 64 units, and they're all veterans. And so, amazingly, it's a very well-run SRO. It's actually in very good condition. We gave them some ideas around HQS, but this is kind of what we're talking about. So they have some difficulties with their cash flow. And so this might be a building that could come to us because they've got the VA providing case management, Operation Dignity providing case management, and they're all veterans. I mean, it's a great model for this SRO. The SRO model for us would not be based on the tenant's income. It would be based on a percentage of the contract rent that the tenant's responsible for, let's say 30% or 25%, and the housing authority would pay the balance of the HAP. So this is not a program where families are coming in and recertifying every year. Basically, we're determining that they're eligible for the program at 50%, and then they are going to have a rent burden that's very specific. If the contract rents $1,000, the tenant's portion may be $250, mm-hmm. having nothing to do with income. And we're going to pay the landlord the balance of that. And so there's no end to a voucher in this housing assistance program. It really is just to assist, to have some permanent units, SRO units, usually in the downtown area, and to have those supportive services on site or partnered with the owner. Eric?
I was just thinking that I always say that a budget is a planning document more than it is a financial document. And this is the result of the planning that the board has done and staff have done really for about a year and a half, 2 years around these different programs. And this is the year we not only fund it, but we implement it. And I think we can have a really powerful impact. And I think it's going to be quite well received by our residents and our city that we serve. But beyond that, I think it can set a model.
Yeah.
And that's what we're supposed to be doing.
Definitely.
And it just kind of all came together. Not only did the work of the special needs, but also the extension, the MTW extension, and going back to the top one before we get to voucher extension. The increase in the voucher payment standard matters. It matters because we couldn't afford to do the housing that we're doing. But what was actually important to me is they were not only did they give us the new voucher payment standard this year, they also gave us the funding behind it. We didn't get that notice until late in February, early March. Usually they make you wait a year. So the first year you get your higher ed, then the next year is when you get your money. So you can go up to that, but you can't serve the same number of people because, you know, you don't get the money. But they increased the voucher money as well. So it made all this a lot more possible, I think, this year than it would have been had they not increased the amount. And in terms of the voucher payment standards, I was on the phone with different staff members and Congresswoman Lee's office because she's getting some language put into appropriations to try and fix what was broken in the way they did the calculations. So I'm excited about watching that.
So you can expect that RFQ to be on the street within the next 30 to 60 days. And so very exciting for us, a lot of hard work. But I appreciate the Special Needs Committee and their focus on many of these solutions.
One last note, this actually does dovetail very well into the mayor's housing plan as well. So, you know, the vouchering in place, preserving units and preserving families in the diversity of Oakland is really at the agenda of that plan, I think, at the heart of it.
Again, another solution, yes. Voucher. Oh, I'm sorry.
Is there a minimum units on the SRO?
10.
Like
10
is 10
for all of them, yeah.
We just don't want to do all the paperwork.
Yeah, half contract is a half contract.
Because otherwise it's just a housing one voucher. You know, it's
right.
You need more. It takes a lot of work to do this.
Another solution that really is already in place, but we will be committed to that, is extending residents' vouchers who are searching. And we have families who can demonstrate that they have been actively searching for units. And if that is the case, then the requests are being approved for additional time above and beyond what our administrative plan allows, because I do have that discretion. HUD does not have a maximum voucher term, so it does allow some discretion for us. Mm-hmm. Many of our families, disabled families, families with children, just are having a hard time. And they don't want to leave Oakland. They're committed to staying here.
And I would say the number one request we get, not just from our participants, but from people helping our participants, whether they be agencies, individuals, case managers, or elected officials, or HUD, is can we do something about extending this voucher when it's expiring?
Yes.
Yep. So we try to work with families as best we can. The word is definitely out that Oakland will extend a voucher. So everybody's coming to Oakland. But we try to do what we can. And then lastly, our landlord-tenant outreach services, we really are going to beef that up in terms of assisting families with searching for units, partnering with our community partners in terms of security deposits and application fees. We will be starting our landlord advisory committee in 2017 again to really get landlords involved. As you know, on the 21st, we're having our Landlord Appreciation Day at 1540 to just show landlords that we really appreciate their participation. The staff is committed to assisting them and to talk to them about some of our incentives and our policies and procedures that sometimes they don't like. But I think if we communicate well with them, that we can bring some of those back who have fled to greener pastures. They are finding that the eviction process is difficult when you don't have any money coming in. And one, I think, benefit is that if a landlord unfortunately has to evict a tenant in Section 8, we actually continue to pay the HAP while the tenant's still in the unit.
Really?
Yes. So they do get some funding where if they are dealing with a market rate tenant, they're getting zero. So I think there's some benefits that we need to champion.
Yes.
What we do here and the work that we do and how we support Oakland and the residents and the landlords. And we just have to do a better job, and we're committed to that.
Well, yes, question. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. I'm really appreciate the landlord incentives that we are just like really wonderful at coming up with and implementing. I'm just curious whether under tenant outreach or some other place that we are also considering how to make sure that our folks know about renters' rights. And I know that they have probably illegal discrimination practices that are going on in the streets, and they deny our people because they're poor. They deny our people because they don't have this or that or three times the amount of income. And I don't know enough to say that's illegal for you to do that. I was told just the other day that on an application, and I haven't seen it, so I can't prove it, but it says that if you have a felony, you need not apply. You know, and I don't know if that's legal. And so I'm just curious whether we have any emphasis on making sure that our people are aware of when they are being treated.
It's a fine line, because staff are advised not to give legal advice. And we do have partnerships with some of the community advocates, BALA, East Bay Community Law Center, Just Causa. So we refer them. We have referral sheets. And the minute that, even when the landlord reports to us a tenant hasn't paid rent, we actually send the tenant out the referral sheet with all of the community resources.
And those are funded primarily now through the city to provide the legal counseling and advice and landlord or and tenant counseling. So those referrals are important. But if you want to advocate for more of that, I think the place to go is actually the more of the city. I know in the mayor's plan and the council have taken actions increasing the dollar amounts available for that purpose. I thought it was the kind of low-hanging fruit in the housing plan, that they should do it rapidly and do it quickly. Because our Section 8 participants have the same problem as everyone else. We are not in the position to provide legal service or fund legal services for either side, landlord or tenant, and we don't. But doing the referral and having it funded through the city or the county sources is really the solution, not OHA. And then making sure that they have those resources, they know where to go get those resources. Early intervention is the key.
Thank you for that, because I do feel that the city of Oakland is also very up on the situation, and it is doing its best. I know Just Cause is leading the tenant protections. Is it a bill or a proposition that's going out? And so we're all behind that to strengthen some of the laws that we have.
They also receive funding for tenant counseling from the city, though.
Excellent. Yeah. Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. In closing, I just wanted to give a moment to my COO, if he had any information he'd like to share.
Not at all. You did a great job.
Yes, I would actually, on behalf of the commission, like to commend everyone for this, because I think that most people would agree right now that the number one problem facing the Oakland community is housing and the cost of housing, the ability to find housing. And we have run into a buzzsaw here, which has prevented us actually from being able to help all of the people that were funded to help, simply because the market got out of whack, all right? And so we have now come up with a whole list of potential solutions here that we're out working on, and we're trying. We are really trying to solve this problem. So I really applaud everyone for this effort, because this was some very good creative thinking, but beyond creative thinking, this is actual implementation that we're going to, and that's where the rubber meets the road, and that's what separates the dreamers from the winners. I really thank everyone for this effort here. This is very, very exciting.
Thank you.
Oh, Commissioner Castillo.
I'm sorry, before you leave, in the event when one of our landlords would like to participate in the housing units turn them into some type of PBV, and most of their folks can qualify under the Section 8 who are in place, what happens then if a person leaves to that unit? He would have to pull from our list? Or
excellent question. Mm-hmm. So that's what we envision. We can use our Section 8 wait list to fill those units. We've got 7,400 families.
Yes.
If we in fact work with nonprofits, they know how to manage a wait list. A mom or pop or someone who hasn't had that experience probably doesn't. So we would refer families
who are searching for units.
Are searching or off the wait list. Wow. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you very much. I'm so excited about that. Yeah.
So we'll move on to family and community partnerships, and we'll be joined by Lenita Wheeler.
And Lenita.
Good evening, commissioners. I'm Lenita Wheeler with the Department of the Family and Community Partnerships Department. We'll be reviewing in my slides the goals for the department for this upcoming fiscal year. FCP is also going to have a new department structure that I'll be reviewing with you, as well as our program areas of focus. We've established some goals for the upcoming year, the first of which is to manage numerous partnerships that we have throughout the community to support our residents with the self-sufficiency activities, health and wellness activities, and so forth. Some listed for you here are the Oakland Private Industry Council and Youth Uprising, but certainly we have quite a few others through school districts, technology organizations, employers, mental health providers. The list is, we feel very comprehensive, and we look forward to adding to it in this upcoming fiscal year. FCP will also oversee several contracts. We have our CiviCorps schools, which supports 6 interns here in the agency throughout the year. Our City of Oakland contract, which you're all very familiar with. Director Michelle just spoke of our sponsor-based HAP through the special needs, and also our classrooms for careers, which is youth employment for our young folks throughout the summers. We will administer 3 grants from HUD, which we're very excited about this upcoming year. We have had family self-sufficiency for quite some time, which supports our families with their escrow accounts. Director Johnson mentioned our Jobs Plus West Oakland. It also came before you at our last board meeting for the contract with the Private Industry Council. And our Ross grant, which we are glad to have received again. It's a 3-year grant that will support a coordinator to assist our public housing families. And we're very excited to have all 3 grants at the same time. Historically, we certainly have had maybe 2. So the new FCP.
Ms. Wheeler, what
yes,
is,
ma'am.
I'm just struggling with some of the acronyms so far. And so what does ROS stand for, please?
A Resident Opportunities for Self-Sufficiency. It's very similar to our Family Self-Sufficiency Program. It focuses on public housing. However, there is no accrual of an escrow account associated with this grant.
It funds only positions.
That's right.
It is in the same funding as a larger group as Jobs Plus and FSS. They all are in with the same piece of funding from HUD. So when they do their allocations, they're all in one budget item, and then they break them out. ROS has been around for a long time, and what it really was trying to do is fund it partial funding of a position. It doesn't fund a full position, because they have a limit of $60,000 or so per position, and where our salaries are for one. And our salary and benefits are higher than that. So it never funds full positions for us, but we always apply, and we've got funding for how many positions? I don't remember.
Four.
For the ROS grant?
4, yeah.
It's one position for 3 years.
So, yeah. And that's all you're allowed. And it was originally started trying to link services for public housing families in developments that didn't have any services. But we apply and we get it because we go after whatever we can go after, and we use it in partnership with all of the other work that Lenita's doing as part of her bigger department.
And the other acronym referenced on this slide, Family Self-Sufficiency, which is the grant where our families can accrue escrow accounts. It is open to both public housing and Section 8 families. And again, that funds positions. This grant funds 4 positions. And we have actually applied for this upcoming year for the number of families that we serve. We're eligible for a 5th position. So we are greatly anticipating to see whether or not we're going to be granted that 5th coordinator position for FSS families.
Thank you so much.
And so the department structure for family and community partnerships is going to a shift. I'm actually quite excited about it myself. That is the department director who will oversee an administrative assistant, manager, senior management analyst, and an assistant director, which is a new position for us to have an assistant director position. Historically, FCP has had a director and a manager. And the director position will no longer supervise coordinators. So under the assistant director, it's the assistant director of community and workforce development. And part of why we're restructuring is we are attempting to align our core services to allow one individual to oversee things that work well together and that we feel are complementary to one another. So our workforce development, you'll see there some of the activities that will take place within it. It will include every initiative, a program, a partnership that has anything to do with our economic development, anything that has to do with our jobs, supporting our families with receiving training for pre-apprentice job readiness or anything else in those in that respect. The education initiative, again, another significant area of the department, includes our partnership with the school district. It also includes our family education and achievement project, which is where our families must opt in to allow us to support them. And this is also where our out-of-school activities reside for our young people during Christmas breaks, summer, spring break, homework after school. And you'll see here we have identified some goals for the Community and Workforce Development Division of the department. We're looking to serve 300 participants in our Jobs Plus West Oakland. This number is for the entire 4 years of the grant. For next year, fiscal year 17, we have a target of serving a minimum of 68 families as we ramp up. And over the course of the grant, we will it will look sort of like a curve. We'll increase the number of individuals we enroll in years 2 and 3 and then begin to decline in year 4. Part of why we are looking to enroll a number of individuals very early on in this grant is because of the earned income disregard. And the longer the individual has the opportunity to take advantage of that incentive, the better off they are economically. We're also looking to increase the average student attendance for those who are enrolled in our FEET program to 95% or above. This is in alignment with the school district's attendance policy and procedures manual, where their target is for 85% of their students to attend school 95% of the time. And I am pleased to report that 19 of our 24 current FEET participants have an attendance rate of 90% or more currently. And so we are looking forward to adding families to participate in this initiative and to support them with increasing their attendance. We're looking to increase our Section 3 list to 50 residents. We currently are around 30, give or take, depending on when we check the roll, as well as hire additional parent ambassadors that would allow us to have 2 at each school. With the restructuring, we are placing additional focus on our workforce development efforts as well as our education efforts, and we are beefing up the work that we're doing in our partner schools. We currently have 7 of them. We're constantly receiving requests of the principals, can we get more parent ambassadors? Do you have anyone else? They're doing an amazing job. We also need to continue to hire because it's bittersweet. We will have our parent ambassadors go on to get hired regularly by the school district. And so we need to make sure that we have a regular pool of individuals to support our partnership there with the school district.
So the parent ambassador program is a workforce development program as well.
That's right.
I want to tell you, I'm so proud to see one of our ambassadors hired at the West Oakland Youth Center.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I go
yes.
And say, she's doing an incredible job. Do we also get requests from other schools other than the 7 for our program? Or are we going to stay really
focused on the 7? We're staying with the 7 now as our pilot.
Okay.
The idea is always, from day one with the education committee, was to try and pilot things, study them, and then if we make them work, if we can have a real dent in the chronic absenteeism in the schools by having ambassadors, we want to be able to take it to scale. And that means continuing to identify additional schools that have high populations of OHA-assisted families or students, and expanding into that. But we're still in the pilot here. We're still struggling with even just keeping the ambassadors on board, because they get hired away. So, you know, we have to get our system down, I think, and get some depth, and then we'll look at it expanding.
So I should slow down a little bit.
We do receive requests from many of our families to, is my child's school a partner school? How can my child's school become a partner school? And in those instances, we support those families certainly with educational enrichment programs that are already available to them through FCP, just not with the focus of the partnership, the data match. With our community and workforce development, I am pleased to report that for 2015, FCP did support 82 residents with becoming employed, though they had been previously unemployed, as well as enrolling 15 of our residents into the Cypress Mandela Training Pre-Apprenticeship Program. And 13 of our residents enrolled in college. We currently have around 100 or so of our residents who are enrolled in college, whether it's community college or four-year college. About a third of them are in four-year college, and about two-thirds are in the two-year school. And as you all know, at our last board meeting, one of our participants received the FADA scholarship that we're so very excited about. So the Family and Community Partnerships Department currently has a manager. We have restructured this position to allow for the Community and Workforce Development Division, if you will. This is where you'll see what feels like the more traditional grouping of our programs within the department. This manager will oversee our family self-sufficiency and ROS coordinators and grants. This is where we are also placing our civic engagement, leadership development activities and programs. Homeownership is there, as well as what you may recognize as our special projects, our computer labs, our health and wellness initiatives, and our various special events, such as toy giveaways, Easter basket giveaways, clothing pantries, things of that nature.
Can I make a comment?
Yes, please.
I seem to be talking a lot tonight, but I just really want to tell you how incredible we are in civic engagement this year. We have just like this increase of participating on many levels with the Residents United Network. I see us in Sacramento. I see us in San Francisco. So I know that my vice chair is very glad to hear that. And so please continue that good work.
Thank you. That is our plan. We look forward to enrolling 40 new participants in our Family Self-Sufficiency Program as required by our grant deliverables and logic model. We are pleased to report that in fiscal year 15, we had 8 graduates, 27 new escrow accounts established. So individuals who previously were not generating escrow who are doing so now. We also look forward to assisting 10 of our homeowners with refinancing to lower interest rates. Many individuals are still interested in the American dream of owning a home. However, those who are currently owning a home, many secured their mortgages when the interest rates were higher. We have been working with them on financial literacy, supportive services, and quite a few. We've supported seven this last year with refinancing their mortgages to lower rates. This saves both our homeowners' money, as well as OHA can pay lower HAP because the overall mortgage amount is less for the family member. And naturally, it supports them with the generation of equity, which we know is so very important for our families. And 5 individuals in 2015, we were able to purchase homes, even in this market.
Wow.
And that's it's less than typical. Cool. Usually we'll have 10, 12 or so each year purchasing homes, but we're very pleased that there were five individuals who were able to become homeowners in 2015. We also look forward to expanding our health and wellness partnership our health and wellness program through the partnership with Samuel Merritt University Nursing Program. They educate our residents on food, nutrition, how it impacts maybe their cholesterol, blood pressure, as well as provide exercise classes at our various public housing locations. And this year, we had a new initiative to where the nursing students are providing wellness checks to our residents. So our residents are asking them, hey, would you mind, you know, checking up on me when you guys are here in my home? And they have the opportunity within the privacy of their home to maybe discuss issues that are more personal or intimate to them and to make sure that they're receiving any helps that they need around maintaining their health. And to Commissioner Castillo's, I'm sure, great delight, we look forward to supporting 25, a minimum of our resident leaders, with civic engagement and training through the additional of community-based organization advocacy partners. So this is also one of the goals for us this upcoming year, to make sure that we're strengthening our leadership capacity of our residents, ensuring that the partnerships are in place for them to understand the various dynamics of leadership, and providing them with a myriad of opportunities in which to express their passions, explore their passions, and exhibit what they've learned and developed in the various workshops.
Thank you. Is our RAB fit under your umbrella? I don't see
them. Yes, the RAB is still under the civic engagement umbrella in our ARC chart, the new redesigned one. That is with the manager with FCP, and you'll see there that its civic engagement is listed there. That includes the RAB, our neighborhood orientation workshop, our resident leadership center, our gathering of the leaders.
Okay. And it'll continue to be supported by Sean Johnson. So, you
know. That's correct. Thank you.
Yes.
You're doing a wonderful job. I just want to ask you, with the 22 partnerships that you have, are they ongoing, or do they come with certain programs, such as PIC? PIC has been around for a long time, Private Industry Council. So will they just work with the Jobs Plus program, or do they do a continuous program with the public housing programs?
The Private Industry Council is actually a partner in the grant that helped us get the grant, so we've awarded them a contract. So they're going to serve our residents, targeted public housing families in the five developments, which are Mandela, Gateway, Peralta, Chestnut Linden, and Campbell Village.
Okay.
And we'll do direct marketing and outreach to their programs, and they'll leverage some of the city funding and programs that they get. The reason they were selected and the reason we wanted to partner with them is because they are the one-stop provider for the city of Oakland, and that's a very important partnership to get the grant.
Okay.
The other good partnership we have is Alameda County Social Services, DPSS. Department of Social Services is a very important partner to get the grant as well.
Okay. And for our family,
PIC can also, I mean, they're good with some of the federal through Barbara Lee's office.
Yeah. They receive funding, I think, as well from the county, probably, because the county gives out money. But for us, it's a partnership. They have designated, you know, a program and enrollment, and they'll participate in our collaborative and do a lot of the direct case management in related to training and placement.
That's right.
But we do other things.
That's correct. And the Private Industry Council, along with many of our partners, our families are eligible for services even if it's not that particular program.
Okay.
Family and community partnerships can refer any resident to the Private Industry Council for job training support and assistance.
Okay.
And throughout the year, we have some partners who support us just every year seasonally during, say, Christmas time. However, it is a yearly partnership. And other partnerships, we have the ability to refer individuals all throughout the year.
Okay.
When we were in D.C. on the Jobs Plus, I was able to talk to a couple of the folks in HUD where I suggested that they get over the old school model and thinking every development is full of public housing and it isn't mixed income and they should serve the whole community, because the purpose of Jobs Plus is to saturate a community with a culture of work and a community that supports work. So for us, how you go into Mandela Gateway with a certain number of public housing and you tell the rest of the folks, no, we don't have the money for you, is our puzzle, and our puzzle is using other community resources. But HUD should get over that, in my view, and we should fund the whole thing.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Andres?
Just so you know, could you touch a little bit on the neighborhood orientation workshop, you know, in concern with Commissioner Hardwick's, you know, issue with Section 8?
Sure. The neighborhood orientation workshop is currently through our civic engagement and leadership section of the Family and Community Partnerships Department. Our current provider who does that for us is Attitudinal Healing Connection. Mm-hmm. We are in the process of submitting the new RFP for that. It will provide incoming residents as well as existing residents information on how to get along with those in their community, how to support or oversee their children. It will help individuals who have never been in subsidized housing before to understand the benefits of subsidized housing, the resources available to them through the Oakland Housing Authority, as well as our community partners. We are looking to expand the number of workshops that are hosted going forward, as well as the number of individuals who are given the orientation. We are keeping the requirement of a resident or two during each of the cohorts being hired as Section 3 to support with a co-facilitation and train the trainers with the neighborhood orientation workshop. While it is required for those who are entering into the Section 8 program to attend, it is also open to public housing residents or any resident of the Oakland Housing Authority, and the Family and Community Partnerships Department provides an incentive I have some ulterior motives in addition to encouraging individuals to go, but when they show up to FCP with their certificate of completion, we'll incentivize them usually with a gift card to either Starbucks or Walgreens or wherever we have available. But also it's our opportunity to begin to try and engage them into the services of our department and really make sure that their families have all of the supportive services that are necessary.
Well, this is another great congratulations on a job well done, because we've just seen in leased housing, we're taking action to be able to house more people. And when I first came here, there was no family and community partnerships. And I remember well, I remember very well standing around in John Gressley's office talking about talking with him about the possibility of being able to do something like this, that essentially we can leverage resources in the community perhaps and elevate all of our residents so we can be more than housing. And now I'm looking at this, and this is just going on to a very significant level, very professional. We're doing more things each year, and you have done one heck of a job here. So, thank you.
It's interesting how everything goes in cycles. If you go even further back in OHA's history, we had one of the great robust resident services departments in the country. And funding and challenges change that. And bringing it back, I think, is something that a lot of us have dreamed of, including Deputy Executive Director Patricia Wells, who I think started in this department and built it into something really great. And we're back in the building mode. But I'm really proud of this this team that we have assembled. I'm particularly proud that we're able to focus into what, and it's a statutory objective under MTW, but beyond that, to really have a focus on workforce development and education on one side, of community building and support, family self-sufficiency on the other side, and to have enough depth in the department to really do some meaningful work. So it's a beginning, and I think with the grant that we've got with Jobs Plus and Ross and FSS, that's a start. And there's always more money if we do well in partner, but if there's not, we want to support what we originally envisioned and the chair was talking about, which is we're the conduit with which other people can do great work.
Yep.
Thank you, Lanita.
Thank you, Director.
Thank you, Commissioners.
And I would also add that this is making us really just a wonderful member of the Oakland community. I mean, when you really think about it, we're doing so many things now. I mean, we're not just housing people, but we're really nourishing the entire community.
And something we didn't mention in the presentation, by the way, was we haven't been before you with summer youth employment because it wasn't something that we got a request from, so we were deciding what to do. But I did want to let you know that I am going to be, I'm in discussions with what they're doing, so there may be something in May meeting that we can get some of our kids working. And so that's in the budget as well, and it wasn't part of the slide because we weren't sure what we were doing, but since late last week, we started discussing, because I would really, consistency in that program is one of the most important things, and I really believe in it, as you know, and I think it's one of the great things that we do for our youth, that we can fund, you know, 250, 300 kids every summer. Next, we have our police department, and I'd like to welcome Chief Duplessis, who will give us a presentation and a little discussion.
Press the buttons, right?
I have this
here. There we go. Carol Duplessis, Chief of Police.
And be sure and talk into the mic. It's misbehaving a little bit.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me now? Well, I'm gonna talk about staffing, the components, just where we're at as far as incidents, Part 1 crime summaries, our youth programs, special operations, and again, we're gonna finish with body-worn cameras, and like Eric Johnson said, that's actually funded in this year's budget, but implementation, that will not be until FY17, so very important that we bring that to the board and to talk about that. We actually made a presentation on body cameras at the last RAB meeting, so we're looking forward to implementing that program. As far as staffing, we're going to remain flat over the next year. I know you see 55 positions, 10 of those are reserve officers that were funded for, and those are unpaid positions. Right now we're at 44, I'm short, vacant 5 officers, police officer positions that we're actually recruiting for right now, and several of the reserve officers that we're looking to fill those positions. So all the rest of my positions are filled. The department actually is broken down into 3 components. It is the Office of the Chief of Police, Field Operations, and Admin Support. Field Operations actually takes the majority of our staff, and they're funded over 2 shifts. 4 squads consist of a sergeant and 4 officers for the day shift and night shift with an overlap. It also has a crime prevention squad, and those are our officers that actually do our special operations. Well, let me not use that term, our crime prevention programs. They are divorced from calls for service, and they deal mainly on a weed and seed type environment where they are not only doing practical law enforcement, but I would probably say 75% of what they do are in fact crime prevention programs, which include our block parties, our summer youth programs, our winter programs, our bullying training that they do for the Oakland Unified School District, SARB, and various other programs. The squad also consists of 1 officer who is assigned to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, ATF, and that is more of a force multiplication environment where I take 1 officer and I pretty much can get 10 officers to work on various situations on housing authority properties, and that has been very, very fruitful for the housing authority. Investigations is under the admin support, and it consists of a sergeant, the 2 investigators, a voucher program officer, and an officer assigned to the Alameda County Narcotics Task Force. These are the people who will be working with Michelle's group as far as the program compliance. The voucher program investigator, he actually searches on a daily basis Oakland police reports, because we don't do active patrol of Section 8 properties. Right. We don't do it. If we get calls for service or we wind up getting information of a problem, we will follow up on that. But as a practical day-to-day operation, we don't do that. We allow the Oakland Police Department to deal with those. They're not our properties. We don't own them, but we will do follow-up for program compliance, which might consist of law enforcement on the front end, and then, of course, on the back end, program compliance, where Michelle staff would come in and have to take whatever issues or compliance issues that they need to. Records and communications falls under my control, under the Office of the Chief, where we have a records communications manager. We have two leads that act as supervisors, and we have six police service aides. That's a dual role where they actually dispatch for the sworn members, and they actually also do external work where they'll respond to non-emergency call for service, issue parking citation, tow vehicle from the property, do property site evaluation reports on cleanliness of the properties, or even advising maintenance of various aesthetic issues that they have discovered on the properties. They also assist in mediations and alternative dispute resolutions with tenants. Now, where are we at as far as incidents?
And
oh, my God.
So far in 2015,
hello? Okay, there we go. In 2015, there were a total of 21,330 incidents, which is roughly about 3% higher than FY 2014 and 21% higher than 2013. So we're watching a steady climb of incidents. As far as the Part 1 crime stats, and Part 1 crime stats are what referred to nationally as the Big Eight, murder, rape, robbery, assault, burglary, larceny, arson, and vehicle theft. And over the course of 2015, we saw a 30% decrease in our Part 1 crime rate on our properties. And when I say the property, I'm mainly considering OP and public housing properties. However, we only saw a 9% decrease in the violent crime rate. Now, Oakland has actually experienced something very different than throughout the state of California after Prop 47, where a lot of cities are all talking about an increase in property crimes. And Oakland has actually experienced the very opposite, where the property crime rate in Oakland is just drastically decreasing, but we still have not gotten a grip on the violent crime rate here in Oakland. And that's something that, of course, that Oakland Police Department, through ceasefire and other operations, is trying to address. Now, when we look at our statistics and we look at how we're impacted on OP and Public Housing Authority properties, you know, we tend to believe that there's two things that are really driving us, and I think they go hand in hand, and one is narcotics enforcement, and the other are disturbances that seem to plague us. On our property, and I'm, you know, I can't speak for the whole city, but I never really believed that Oakland necessarily had that great of a violence problem as much as Oakland had a drug problem that contributed to violent crimes. So for us, it has worked that we have been focusing on our narcotics investigations, as also in along with a weed and seed concept, where we're also looking at community partnership, and we're trying to bring all of our community into the fold to help us deal with a lot of problems we have. Now, in seeding, you all are aware of our youth programs, and next year we are planning 24 youth and family events for the summer. This summertime, and that's going to include block parties, bowling trips, bike riding. We're going to take the kids to some hikes and various other activities and really keep the kids busy and really try to partner with families in addition to our block parties in Lockwood and Peralta. Commissioner Castillo, you had a question?
I just, you thank you, Chief. You
sure.
Said weed and seed?
Weed and seed, yes.
What is that?
Well,
oh,
weed and
marijuana?
Seed, yeah, oh. No. Weed and seed concept was something that came out, and it was under the Cops Moore grant in 1999, about the time Clinton was leaving office. And the concept was that you bring law enforcement and partners into various areas, and the first thing you do is you saturate the area with crime prevention. and you eliminate, you make arrests, you do various things, but then you follow up and you seed. And in seeding it, you imply the community programs, and you provide the assistance to the community in order to do it. Now, why that is so important is because with the law enforcement coming in at the beginning, and we've experienced this in Lockwood, Campbell Village, and various other areas, is community is very reluctant to try to provide information or to partner with law enforcement unless they see law enforcement at the front end coming in and trying to rid themselves of various problems. That's why communication is very important, that we can try to determine exactly what the issue is. And the one thing we don't try to do in OHAPD is think for our residents. They know what the problem is. We try to get it from them and not try to assume anything. And it's worked very well for us. So in our seating, we will do these programs. In addition, 140 community meetings, and these are the NCPCs as well as meetings that we have on our own site. Now, those meetings for us are not necessarily lip service as far as our staff just to be going. Our officers are all mandated to write crime reports on these meetings that they attend, so we can look at every one of them, we can do analysis on them, and we can really try to structure our patrol and where we put our attention based upon the information that we receive from this.
And in terms of the community events we have, and particularly the excursions, the police service is really helped by property management, family, community partnerships, and it's really an all hands on deck when we do a big event, which is one thing. But the other part I wanted to make is, although these are really the seeding, trying to build relationships early on with youth and with the police department, there are also summer enrichment activities, and they all have a really positive impact on the level of retention or lack of learning loss that occurs during the summer. So keeping youth engaged during the summer months in basic activities like going to the zoo or actually improves lessens the amount of learning loss they experience during the summer. So it directly relates to what Lanita is doing in the education end.
Absolutely. And Eric's right. We couldn't do that without OPO, Mark's staff, and especially Lanita's staff in doing these. Matter of fact, at these block parties, Lanita will have tables set up to actually have residents signing up for services, providing the services, and others also on the backpack program. I believe in August she uses it for the signups for the kids as far as going back to school. So I know I'm saying this wrong, butchering what she does. She does a lot, but it's amazing how the partnership between various departments come together for these programs. In addition to National Night Out and the Toy Drive in December, which I think is one of the most fabulous things that we do, to see the kids in December come get their toys and just have a fun day at the service center. And of course, we'll continue with our Cadet and Explorer program, where we have a lot of new kids. But those are just some of the things that we do. I mean, quite frankly, as we go throughout the year and we discover various things that are required or needed, we add on. We're not married to the plan. We are very flexible, and we will continue looking for different ways of evaluating and looking to provide services to our residents. Now, the special operator, go ahead.
I just had one question.
Sure.
The NCPC meetings, what's reoccurring there at the NCPC meetings?
Well, some of them, are pretty good. They actually come up with new information. They're really paying attention to the community. At a lot of them, it's the same thing. I mean, some of the, I hate to say it, but some of the communities, they just don't want poor people living in their neighborhoods. And that's a lot of what you get, from these meetings. A lot of them, they don't have a lot going on, and more of the attention seems to be pointed towards OPD and not us. Now, we are partners with OPD for ceasefire and various other operations, but we're not going to duplicate what they're doing. So when they do have a lot of the reoccurring issues that they have, well, OPD is going to have to be on their own with those things, mm-hmm. because we need to focus on the things that we pay attention to. Mm-hmm. But, we a lot of them, we throughout the year, we'll decide that we're not going to go to the meeting anymore if they continue not having issues, and we'll start going to others. It just to make sure that we show our face. But we do actually try to attend every NCPC where we have a property at least twice a year. Twice and we will absolutely hit them. And in most cases, I would say about 80% They don't have a lot of issues for us. They don't. But that 20%, it's enough to take the time up for my department and Mark's.
Thank
it's
you.
a lot of problems.
Okay, thank you.
You mean that's the 20% of NCPC's?
That's correct.
20%
of NCPC meetings.
Right,
yes.
Right.
Ms. Lee?
I have a question around the Cadet and Explorer program.
Yes.
Are those for the older elementary and junior high?
Well, the Explorer program are for high school kids between 14 and 18 years old. The Cadet program is the graduation of the Explorer program, and those are for kids 18 to 24. Those kids must be college enrolled, taking a full load, and must maintain a C average while they're in college. They are paid anywhere from $12.50 an hour to $15 an hour, and they are required to work a minimum of 20 hours a week in the police department, where we assign them to various staff. Some are assigned to my office, communications. They're doing real work, you know, in the department. So it's a very structured program. And I don't know if you guys remember, but about a year ago, we had a couple graduates. One actually obtained her master's degree in psychology. She's gone off to bigger and better things. Another one obtained her bachelor's degree from San Jose State. She's now working for the DA's office.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I don't care if they want to be police officers. I just want our residents to be educated and productive members of society and do great things, do some really great things.
That's wonderful, Chief DePlessis. Wanda, do you have any programs for those at the junior high age, which is also a critical age?
Those are mainly our summer youth program that we invite them to. Yeah, and we cannot invite them for the Cadet and Explorer program because it's actually run through through the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts of America through Learning for Life. And there is basic criteria that we have to adhere to in order to enroll and to maintain kids in that program. We can't go outside of that. It'd be nice to have some 12, 13-year-olds. We just can't. It's against the rules.
I see.
Yeah. So we do the best we can on the other end. So the other end of the weeding are special operations that and I always preface this that it's not what I want the department to look like. I'm very, very clear. My people know that too. I cringe at the fact of watching my officers in tactical gear going kicking doors in. I much like the other look of they're in their professional uniform, taking kids to camping trips or dealing with things on the softer side, but it's necessary. So far in 2016, we've executed 18 search warrants. 15 resulted in narcotics and weapons. We've recovered over 2 pounds of methamphetamine, 2 pounds of heroin, 6 pounds of marijuana, 33,000 in cash with a total street value of 250,000, including 7 firearms. We're very busy on that side of it, as far as trying to weed out a lot of problems, you know, on and about our properties. It's absolutely necessary, but it really makes a lot of neighborhoods safe, and we do get quite a bit of thanks from our residents and also the neighbors thank us a lot for what we do. Now, body cameras, I just want to talk a little bit about this. At the May 23rd meeting, this will come before you for approval, but we want to make sure that we had a chance to bring this to your attention prior to it coming to the meeting. It was funded, body cameras were funded in FY 2016. However, they won't be implemented because of the length of time it took us to get through the process to select a vendor for the cameras. And we actually took well over a year to decide on what we were going to do, and we actually vetted the process by getting the manufacturer of 5 cameras, of the 5 best ones, getting it to our officers, exploring the pros and cons of it, conducting surveys for the cameras, and from that developing a scope in order for us to issue an RFP for this. In addition to that, and most importantly, we wanted to make sure that our policy was the best policy possible for our residents. And we looked at a lot of the good things and a lot of the bad things that had occurred with a lot of other police departments, OPD, Alameda County Sheriff, and various other ones. And we believe, you know, from the vetting of our policy through our attorney, Myers Nave, that we came up with a really, really good policy for the having the cameras. And the purpose of it is we want to actually to gather events, and we want transparency. We want to make sure that citizen encounter and traffic stops, other incidents of these natures are done in a manner, like I said earlier, that the community wants us to do. We are not in the business of providing law enforcement and shoving it down their throat. We're going to police the way the community wants us to police. And we believe that this is something that the community wants us to do. Unlike a lot of departments, the activation of our cameras is going to be mandatory. It's not going to be a discretionary issue where officers are going to get to choose whether they turn it on or off. They have to turn it on. And we're going to list the incidents. And I placed a few of them. The policy is a lot longer of various situations in which they will have to turn on their cameras. That's contact, traffic stops, foot pursuit, various things were in the public view, high-risk encounters that includes those special operations that they're involved in. However, the one thing that we did do and we did look at, and we actually believe that this is something that might actually become somewhat of an issue for a lot of agencies later on, is the Fourth Amendment issues of private dwellings. It has never, ever been my understanding that just because we're police officers that we can just step into people's houses in what we consider a non-hot pursuit type environment and videotape you in your own dwellings. And if it's considered what we call a code call, where you call us regarding a matter that you want to discuss with us, that we're not in hot pursuit, we're not there to make an arrest, we're just to obtain information that is crime related. Let's assume that it is. What the contents of your house and your intimacy should be protected from us. Therefore, our policy is going to state that our officers are going to be mandated when they go to a call for service such as that they have to advise the people that they are wearing a body camera. Yes. And if they're told that they're not comfortable with it, then our officers are mandated to turn the camera off. Okay. And turn it without question. Okay. Yeah, we want to make sure that our residents are very comfortable with how we're going to proceed and what we're going to do. Now, the law is very specific in hot pursuit. If, in fact, we have to go inside there because a crime is being committed, is about to commit, or is in progress, then we don't have to ask. I mean, we're going to keep the camera on, and we're going to continue videotaping all the way throughout the incident. But for those situations that's not, we're going to advise them that we do have a body camera, and the camera is activated.
Switch again? You're talking too long. That's coming.
See, they're letting them know that they're having it.
Yes. Yeah, let's do the other one too, if you have another batter. Commissioners, I'm back. Now, there are restrictions also for the officers. I mean, this is not a toy for them, clearly, we definitely want the officers to use it, but the policy also puts prohibitions against them as far as destroying, editing, tampering with copying, taking the camera out of the police department for doing things that they should not do. We definitely want to make sure that it's a tool and the tool is used appropriately. So we have a good policy, and the policy is already in place. The officers have all been trained on the policy. The officer will be retrained on the policy prior to the issuance of the body cameras, but our date that we would probably go live on them will probably be around August of 2016. So again, that'll become before you in August of 2016. It'll become before the board on May 23rd at the board meeting for approval. And that is it, commissioners. Is there any questions?
Commissioner Castillo.
Chief, you disarm me with such a high regard for our people and how you consider all the parameters of your department, not just the BWCs, how we consider how this would affect our people. And I'm always amazed at your thoughtfulness and your just great humanitarian just in running this department. I really hope we never lose you.
Thank you. That's probably not going to happen.
Truly. I think I have just two questions. Sure. One was going back to something that wasn't mentioned, but what are your thoughts on gun buyback programs? I don't know if OPD does it, but I noticed you only picked up 7. I know there's probably 1,000 on the streets. What is your thoughts on that?
I love them. I think gun buyback programs are great and very important, but not with HUD dollars.
Okay.
We actually did a buyback program in 1990. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, 2000. It was toward the end of the FEDEP program, and we understand that the Bush administration was not happy with that at all when they found out what we did with that money. We actually provided $10,000. You know, to help, and we sent our mobile command center, and we collected a lot of weapons. You know, I do have asset forfeiture funds that are non-federal dollars that could be used for something like that, but we just have not had the time and the right venue to do that. And I know Oakland has talked about that, and you know, when the right time comes, it might be something that I talked to Eric about, that we might actually partner with them. But you know, the question is, how do we target that specific to our properties? And I think it would be great, and who cares, as long as the gun come from anywhere, we get off the street, I don't think anybody would be complaining. But, you know, clearly if we can remove more firearms from our properties, that would be wonderful. That would be absolutely wonderful.
Thank you. And sure. Me too. I also think that would be wonderful.
Sure.
I'm curious about where the data will be going when the videos are being taken off the body-worn cameras. Mm-hmm. Is there like a central place that we're going to be holding all this video? Is there someone? Remember how you told us that even though we have cameras, it doesn't matter because there's nobody watching the camera?
That's correct.
How does this system work behind the scenes?
Well, the body cameras are going to be a supervisory role also, where the sergeants and lieutenant and captain back there, they're going to be mandated to occasionally view the cameras to make sure that the officers are behaving and complying with the policy. And that's going to be done on a weekly basis. The one thing we didn't want to do as far as capturing the video is maintain it in the cloud like a lot of other agencies. We wanted to really control that information. So we will be storing it in a server at the service center. And the database will be large enough that we'll be able to maintain 2 years, 3 months worth of data. After that, unless the video is marked or is in current investigation, it'll be destroyed after that period of time, because that's as long as we're mandated to keep the information, you know, under a retention period. So we'll be maintaining that at the service center. The officers also will have access to be able to view their video. What we're buying is very dynamic. They'll actually be able to pull it up on their iPhones or smartphones, and they'll be able to play it back and to be able to look at what occurred to make sure even they include an accurate, complete report. So that's going to be something that's going to be monitored constantly.
Wow.
And again, it's part of our process will be supervised, will be mandated to look at their staff to make sure that their staff is compliant with the policy and whatever occurring in the field is done properly. We're not going to be surprised later on to find out that we're not doing it right. Now, I don't suspect that'll happen. Last year in 2015, our department had 5 citizen complaints that we investigated. Every one of those complaints that we investigated were unfounded. Mm-hmm. It has not been like that in years. We've had times where all the complaints were where we have found that the officers were at fault. But we have a really fantastic group. Mm-hmm. With that, we also only had 5 use of forces of all the arrests. And I believe our statistics show that we only use force in 0.3% of all arrest situations that we were encountered in last year.
That's amazing.
And I believe the figure was even lower for complaint as far as citizen contacts. Is that we are very professional. Our officers, they do things right. People are not complaining about them. Our surveys that we brought to you last year showed that the citizens felt, 92% of them felt that our officers were very competent and very professional. So I think this is only going to enhance that. And, you know, in 3 years when we do the next survey, I expect the figure to be higher, even though if it's not, you know, I won't be overly concerned.
Thank you, Chief. How many are we buying? Is it one for every officer?
We're buying 50 of them.
50
We're one for every officer plus some spares.
Oh, of course.
And because we need some for the reserve officers, too, when they go out.
And this is my last question. This is my geek mind coming to me. So you're wirelessly sending the data up to your servers? Is that what it is? As they're being filmed? Or?
No, at the end of the shift, they'll put them in a docking station.
Mm-hmm.
And the video will upload.
Okay.
The cameras are capable of holding up to 12 hours of video.
Okay.
So they'll upload at the end of the shift.
Okay. Unless something really serious happens, then they might upload. Mm-hmm. Right there. Or
the supervisor will come take the camera pull the officer off the streets. And right. Yeah, what we have is what we have at that point.
Yes,
you're absolutely correct.
Thank you, Chief.
You're welcome.
I have a question.
I don't know if I even should ask. Have you ever had to shoot anyone?
Me personally?
No.
The department?
Yeah, the department.
Yes, the last shooting we had was in 2009. One of our officers responded to a call where another officer was drugged underneath the car after a fight. And ironically, when the other officer got there, the guy was actually getting ready to roll over the officer again.
Oh, no.
Yeah, he fired 2 shots at the moving vehicle and shot the suspect in the arm and waited for more officers he shot him in the shoulder twice, waited for the other officers to arrive. Ironically, you know, and we actually gave medals to both officers. So one officer was injured, and we thought she was not going to be able to come back to law enforcement. She was out for about 9 months. The other one did everything so professionally that we really couldn't even find a flaw in what he did. Ironically, it was his wife. They were married, and she was the one at the end. And he never even went down to check on her. He stood where he was and did things by the book, absolutely by the book. And it was really ironic. Mm-hmm. Well, now, we don't have husband and wife, what are you thinking, patrolling. It happened to be the day that we were actually holding the sergeant's assessment center, and we had to put him out there in order to cover the shifts. But they don't work together on the same shifts.
Okay.
Yeah. But other than that, the only shooting we had prior to that was in 1985.
Okay.
It was the last shooting prior to that. No, I'm sorry. We had one in 2008. But I want to forget that one because that officer's not with us anymore. Okay. He didn't shoot anybody, though.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
Sure.
You may.
I think I've made this comment before, but when that shooting happened in 2009, the chief asked me to go down to the police department, and he had the investigation done by OPD homicide because he wanted it to be an independent investigation. And they asked a lot of questions, and, you know, to both both officers, and one of them, who was, I think, a very experienced homicide detective, pulled me aside, and he said, the OPD, OHAPD, is incredible. They don't have officer-involved shootings. They are so professional. I'm just always amazed at what a wonderful job they do, and they found absolutely nothing, nothing in that regard, nothing done improperly. But he was also just commenting about his interaction with OHAPD over the years.
Thank you.
Well, I can assure you, we all feel likewise. Mm-hmm. And yes. And what's really cool, and what's actually really cool is, you know, word kind of like floats around through the ether. And I've had numerous times, people don't know that I'm on the commission, and I will hear, I will hear comments on the excellence of OHAPD. And so this is really a cool thing, because this is what we're talking about here, about OHA becoming a really superior and important member of the community. And Carol, you're doing one heck of a good job of that. And I can actually see that a lot of time and effort went into this body camera policy here. And I think this is really important, because a lot of people are going to think, well, they're cameras, what's the big deal? It is a big deal. Yeah. A lot can go wrong with this stuff. And I really applaud you for taking the time and doing the detailed work to come up with a really, really comprehensive policy that I think is going to serve us well. So very nice.
Well, let me, I mean, I don't want you thinking that I'm some genius, but because I'm not. Even though I like to tell people
you're
that.
Okay.
But Sergeant Malik is sitting in the back, and he is the one I have to thank for. I mean, he really did.
Thank you,
99%. I mean, I always call it that, you know, you're supposed to carry the ball 99 yards down the football, hand it to me so I can step up the 1 yard line and spike it. And he carried the ball. So I want to thank him.
Thank you. Yeah. Very cool.
Oh, I have one quick question. Mental health. When we have to call 5150, I know, is there times when you partner with OPD? Because now the Oakland Police Department has GART come out. They have like a Alameda County Behavioral Health Services, maybe a company officer. Is there times you partner with the Oakland Police Department to make sure? Because mental health issue, 5150 calls, I know.
Yeah, absolutely. We do. The same process. We use their policy. Matter of fact, you know, Oakland has some of the best crisis intervention training, and we're actually trying to get 100% of our department trained by them under crisis intervention over the next year. We have a great number of officers already trained. In addition to that, we also partner with the Alameda County Forensic Science Group that actually deals with homeless people. As we know, a lot of the homeless have mental health issues also, and we try to get services to them in a lot of the areas that we find homeless around our property. But right now, I'll tell you, as far as strategic planning within the police department, mental health issues is probably at the top of our list, and not just dealing with adults, but what we're trying to look at is and concentrate on juveniles also, because it's something that's spreading, and it's if we don't get a grip on it, it'll hit us hard ultimately later on, and we don't want to be on the news like others. Clearly, we want to try to help as much as we can.
So the answer is sometime you do partner with.
All the time.
Okay, thank you.
No, we partner with OPD on that. And it's just not Oakland. We would call services out ourselves.
Services.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Chief. That was a terrific presentation. Let me tell you where we are, so we'll check in. We're almost done with the presentations, and then we're going to go over the two budgets. And, Tracy, you'll do that. The last two are first about our capital projects, which we make a significant investment, and then our new development projects that we have booked this year. So for the capital projects, I'm going to bring up three different directors who you know. William Bailey, who's a director of capital improvements, Mark Schifferl, who's the director of property management, and Anna Kadanovskaya, who's the director of asset management. And just so everyone knows, the director of property management handles all the physical units that we manage or manage via contract for OPI. And Anna handles all the outsourced management companies, so both the mixed finance and also the ones that we contract out traditionally. So she manages the management companies. She also provides a host of other associated and related work for the nonprofits for Phil to keep those meetings all moving and documented and done correctly. So I'll turn it over to you. You may have to share a mic. I don't know if it's working or not.
Good evening, Commissioners. William Bailey, Director of Capital Improvements.
Good evening, Commissioners. Mark Schifferl, Director of Property Management.
And Annika Danowska, Director of Asset Management. I think.
This evening, Commissioners, we will be discussing OP's project based voucher sites, public housing sites, and non-federal expenditures and our administrative buildings project plan. So currently, we have $8.5 million budgeted for our capital outlay, which $7 million is that from our MTW for our major rehab projects. Mm-hmm. One of the projects we have currently now is 5730 Elizabeth. It's located in east of Oakland. It's a 20-unit site that we've been working on, and the completion for that is scheduled for late summer of this year.
That one, if you remember, was redone many years ago, and it had some dry rot in the stairs and some other work that had to be done. So we did relocate everybody, and it's been offline for about a year with the work being done. We're in discussions with the sheriffs about expanding the MOMS program into the PACT program, from our end anyway, parents and children together. We're not going to make any distinctions between how someone defines the family. Yeah. And that would move from Seminary, an 11-unit site, onto Elizabeth, a 21-unit site with two bedrooms and three bedrooms. Yes. So we're hoping to have that occur this fall, and I'm hopeful. I did meet with Sheriff Ahern. We talked over the program and our mutual concerns and challenges, and I think we're on the same page.
Okay.
Go on.
Okay. Also, later in the summer, we'll be doing a full renovation of 2495 94th Avenue, that's located in the deep east. This is a six unit. It's a vacant site. It's been offline for about 10 years now. And that's going to be an extensive interior, exterior, and hardscape area as well. Okay. Also, we'll be continuing to do our interior vacant rehab projects that we do every year.
Thanks, William. And just to expand a little more, that's the interior renovation projects that we showed you, taking units from the former public housing sites that we have that are now OP and renovating them to brand new. So literally when residents go into units now, it's not this kind of older looking unit. They have new floors. William's team does the walls and painting and countertops, cabinets, and they look absolutely fantastic. On the OP side, so this is a picture in the left-hand side of 5730 Elizabeth that William was just describing, and the stairwells you'll see are now open, and part of the renovation piece that was really important was to take the stairs, which were dry-rotting from moisture intrusion, water intrusion over the years, and now they're open. I believe that will also help Chief with the line of sight to see through the property, because they used to have siding around them so you couldn't even see through the site. But now when Chief comes on to staff comes on site, they can look straight through and see what's going on. And then on the bottom corner, you'll see 2425 94th, which was the 6-unit site that William just described. It's been offline for about 10 years. So they'll go through and do a full renovation. On the OP side, we've got about $1.5 million set aside for major maintenance and repair projects. That includes paving and drainage improvements, roof repair, landscaping. A lot of those we pair with CID, so William's team is absolutely imperative to help us get these done. We've got 950 40th Street. The trees that are kind of at the front of the property have lifted up sidewalks, so we're going to take out the trees, redo the sidewalks, and work on the parking lot. That's in West Oakland. In North Oakland at 357 through 365 49th Street, we want to redo the hard surface replacement and redo the drainage at the site, including the parking lot area. And then lastly, the picture that you see also on the left side at 610 East 18th, we're going to go through and do a exterior paint, roof, gutters, landscaping, and parking lot. Residents will be in that building while we're doing that, too.
And just a comment on 950 40th Street. We're working with this city of Oakland to on the tree removal and the sidewalk a repair project in that area.
And then next, for the public housing sites, we've got 19.4 million budgeted for capital outlay. A couple of the major projects that we're carrying over that we need to get done this year, the parking area drainage and repaving in a couple of areas of Lockwood. And at Peralta Village, the parking lots there need to also have some work done to them, so we're going to slurry seal and do some repaving project areas there as well.
Slurry seal is when they put tar covering on top of the existing asphalt rather than rip it out and repave it.
It's not an acronym,
it's
but it's a term.
Preservation measure that can really save you money in the long run.
And at my sites, and I just to give a really short introduction, we have five senior sites and one big family site, Campbell Village. There are about 383 units at the senior sites and 154 units at Campbell Village. For the senior sites, one of the biggest projects is the project for the Oak Grove North and Oak Grove South. Last year, we did a physical need assessment, and the physical need assessment showed that there's a lot of deficiencies in the buildings. There's a lot of dry rot around the windows. There's problems with the roof. There are problems with the deck. The community room looks, you know, very worn off. Some of the unit restoration need to happen because, you know, our senior residents have been taking care of the units, so the units are clean, the units are nice, but the carpet in the units is more than 10 or 15 years old, and this is beyond the life expectancy of any carpet.
And just to remind everybody, this is public housing, so you can't put debt on it. You need to save your money and then pay for it. So that's what we're doing.
And it might seem like a big number, $16 million, but it also will include some of the relocations because the tenants, both of the buildings are almost fully occupied. There's one or two vacancies, so in order to restore the unit, you would need to move the rest in out. There's going to be some building system upgrades, so for that period of time, you would need to move people so they will still continue to have hot water where they live or a roof over the head where they live.
But there's nothing harder than renovating a senior property that's at nearly 100% occupancy. It's not something anybody relishes, but it's something we need to do. We're hoping to take to the approach where we can do, they're called unit stacks, where identical units go up and down three stories. If we can get one or two stacks, then we can just move through the property in that way. But it's going to take some work with our contractor and our engineer to figure out how best to approach it. It'll also depend on the physical needs that we are finishing up. Okay. A more comprehensive assessment of what work will be done, and Phil are aggressively bidding that out and getting the work done, and we'll hopefully move forward. They're great properties. Yeah. They're on 16th and 17th. They look the same from the outside, but they're like down the street and around the corner. Really worth preserving, and I hope we get them fixed in the next 18 months.
So the chair asked how many units, director?
There are 77 units in Oak Grove North and 75 units in Oak Grove South.
Oh, okay.
77
and 74, right?
Or 75.
Yeah, okay, good. Okay.
Just one question about that. When you say comprehensive renovation, that's not full. So there's a difference.
There is a difference. It's going to focus on the physical needs assessment, and we're going to have some destructive testing, they call it, but where they actually rip down the stucco and look behind the walls. We're very concerned about the balconies, not just because of what happened in Berkeley, but we've been concerned for a couple of years. We also want to do some improvements to the HVAC because that's been a problem with that building. The solutions have been very cost ineffective, so we want to see if we can do a building-wide solution and put in something new that's not only more affordable, but also more affordable to the residents. So it's not 100% rehab, relocate everybody. It's going to be solo by solo, keep people in place to the greatest extent possible.
Okay. Is it cost effective not to go in and do a full reno right now versus
Well, we're hoping the work is going to preserve the units for another 25 years.
And there's some units where you need to do minimal work, and there's some units that need to be fully restored, depending on how long the tenant has been in the union, depending on some housekeeping.
Okay. That's what I'm curious as to, are we spending less money now to spend more money later?
And we're hoping this solves the issue. One of the things we do have to look at in addition to the renovations is also seismic, to make sure we meet the seismic, whether this is a soft story or not. An engineer will have to tell us that. We do not know yet. And we don't know what the actual ordinance is going to be in Oakland, but we're going to have to cross those bridges when we get there. But the first floor is parking, so there may be a soft story. Mm-hmm. Has a lot of concrete walls, so it may be exempt. We're going to have someone figure it out.
Okay. So the next item.
Let me just throw one other question in there. So at Oak Grove North and South, that $16 million investment, mm-hmm. that's essentially then a 30-year investment. So in other words, that's really a complete rehab to the mm-hmm. property, right?
Yeah, we're hoping to get another 30 years life out of it. There'll be during the 30 years, there'll be things like mm-hmm. roof maintenance, and that will continue to come up. But what we're hoping is to give it the whole upgrade.
That's coming out to be kind of reasonable.
It is,
I think, because
absolutely.
We're looking at $105,000 per unit. You can't build something for that.
And there's four elevators. One of them has to be done. Yeah. We've done the other three earlier, and it's three stories with parking. They're big properties, and they're right downtown, and they're absolutely worth preserving. And this is a good deal for preservation. At some point, we want to try and get them off the public housing program and onto something that makes us a little more money every month. But that's another day.
One more question: the $16 million is just for one fiscal year, or because it sounds like this project is going to take longer than
it may. And what we chose to do this year is budget the major projects. Mm-hmm. This will probably take more than this fiscal year. Okay. So we're committing it now. We will start doing the project. What we don't spend this year will go into next year's budget. And the same thing will hold true when we get to the development list that Phil's going to have.
Okay.
Thank you.
And the next building on the list is Harrison Towers. Harrison Towers is also a senior building. There's 101 unit in the building. One unit is allocated for the resident manager. Mm-hmm. And the projects for this building are the interior renovation of the units mm-hmm. at $800,000 and the window replacement. Okay. And Mr. Johnson mentioned the soft story retrofit, one of the buildings, which is located at MacArthur Boulevard, 2001 MacArthur. It's a 30-unit building, also a senior building. This building definitely have a soft story retrofit because the second floor is basically hanging over the lobby area, so there are literally no support under it except for a few beams, and we have been looking into the engineer to design scope of work to see how this building could be seismically retrofitted. And also, we have 30 units, and the units have not been renovated. They have been sort of a piecemeal replacement here and there, but a more comprehensive assessment needs to be done on what needs to be
done. And the exterior and a lot of other work was done during ARA days in 2009-10-11, mm-hmm. and a lot of it is just a great-looking building now. There's just some interior improvements. In terms of the seismic, what we have to do is put I-beam, they're upside down U's kind of in there. And we're ballparking a figure based on some knowledge of other properties in town that have done it.
Okay.
We're not certain. It's a ballpark is all I wanted to say, is this is based on what other people have experienced, could go up or down based on what our engineer says we have to do.
Right.
Now,
Commissioner, I'm jumping forward. Do you have another question?
These amounts include materials and labor?
Yes.
Yes.
And how big is the team that take on this, like not just this piece, but the other piece as well? How many people do we have working on all these?
Well, some of these will be contracted out. The seismic retrofit will be contracted out.
Okay.
Some of them will be done in-house, Elizabeth Street, 94th and 95th. Mm-hmm. So it's a mix. And even when we do it in-house with Four Scout, some things we contract out, like the roof.
Right.
So it's a puzzle. I don't know the number of total employees that will work on it from both the contractor and OHA's side during the course of the project. I don't know that we could come up mm-hmm. with that figure.
It sounds like an incredible project to manage,
Well, you've got three folks here who are going to try and make it happen. And
you guys must be incredible. I'm just seeing that there's a lot of pieces to this and a lot of people to maneuver and manage and materials. And how I can't even imagine how many projects do you have going on at the same time. I'm just really respecting the process of what we're doing in this city.
So another item on the list is Campbell Village. Campbell Village is actually a family development in West Oakland, and it has 154 units. And one of the items for Campbell Village is bathroom windows and ventilation fans. The windows are truly old and truly obsolete, and there's really no parts to replace them. So a lot of residents have been complaining that the windows do not stay open and do not allow any ventilation in the unit, and that in turn creates a problem of mold, and which results sometimes in relocating somebody and trying to do mold remediation. So to permanently address this problem, the site priced out the ventilation fans in the bathroom and also comprehensive window replacement, and the comprehensive almost pretty much in almost in every unit because the windows are quite old.
And Campbell, I think, is 156?
154. There's some units that already have fans because as the tenants are moving out, the management installed them. But there haven't been that much of the attrition at that development. So it would be nice to do it as a one project, to be fair to all of the residents. And then also a surveillance system. Campbell Village actually conducts they do not do a lot of evictions. They do a lot of lease enforcement. And right now there's about 6 vacancies at Campbell Village, and half of them were the result of aggressive enforcement efforts. And I just want to say thank you to Mr. DePlessis, because the police reports that he provides to Campbell Village residents allow to make this lease enforcement actions effortless and without a lot of impact on the staff and the nearby residents. And hopefully we can get the surveillance system, which will improve the safety of the community and at the property. And the last item on the list is Palo Vista Gardens. Palo Vista is a beautiful community of 100 senior units. And probably the last remaining item for improvement there would be the elevator overhaul. There are 2 elevators because there are 2 buildings with the elevators. Both of them are 3-story high. There's 36 units in one of the building and 27 units in another building. And this project will potentially require some relocation, not for all of the residents, but for the residents that live on the second or third floor who have some mobility issues.
And they may have other accommodations that they can make rather than relocation. Mm-hmm. The elevators were not done as part of the ARA rehab because we didn't have enough money at that time. So now we're doing it.
Okay, so this was the rehab that we did using the force account.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah,
and we didn't do the elevators.
And the elevators were okay, got it.
Also, to add on to that, coming to you, later this month, you will be seeing a contract requesting a contract for a elevator company to service Palo Vista and the various other elevators within the agency. Okay. Two other items we have, the non-federal and administrative buildings. This non-federal is a 6-plex at 1242 95th Avenue, which we will be doing a full interior rehab and exterior along with landscape. Just a little history behind the 6-plex. It's a 6-plex, and this is a non-federal encumbrance. This property was donated to the authority back in early 1980, and we paid off the approximate balance that was considerably less at the time for the property, and now we estimate the repairs to be about $500,000 to bring this property back online.
So this is part of the State 6. You've heard it referred to over the years.
The state six.
It was given to OHA. It has no federal encumbrances. So we're going to restore it using non-federal, and we'll lease it to Housing Choice Voucher families who are searching, but we don't have to record anything if we do it this way. We don't have to go through a bunch of HUD hoops if we do it this way.
Oh, I see. Very good. So that'll take care of six of our voucher hunters.
Yes.
Six.
How big are they? I think they're 3 bedrooms.
Yes, sir, they are.
Right? Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
They're a nice layout, too, I'll tell you. I think when we finish with it, it'll lease. I think it's a good street.
And final is our administrative buildings. We have approximately $2.9 million budgeted. The major, and this is in relation, all balanced around the removal and our lease housing department moving to 1540. That's given space here in this building on the first floor. So we'll be renovating the lease housing, IT, and our finance areas. Also, addition to administrative building, the service center, which is well overdue for exterior painting and a roof replacement. 1180.
That's where the police 25th. Department's located.
Oh.
Yeah. And one of the things we're trying to do is, through the moves and consolidation and space planning, is to consolidate more administrative departments in this building, including general services and okay. Phil and some folks who are up the street. And also, by default, relieving some of the pressure from the service center. It's very overcrowded work environment. It has not only the police services, it has some general services and some skilled trades, and it has a couple of amps from Mark. So it's a very crowded building, and we need to relieve that pressure and get the rest planned out. The projects on Harrison Street, what we're proposing this year, we're behind on getting our space planning done and our engineer on board, but that will be coming, I believe, in May, if not May, June, to do the strategic planning and the drawings and all of that for the first floor here and the second floor. But we're going to do the first floor. It'll be done by force account once we get the drawings approved and create a more fluid office space with flexible work areas and get rid of all of the different cubby holes you go through. We're going to try and open up the office space to the windows in the courtyard so that people get natural light and have the actual offices have front glass like the ones at 1540, but they're back against the wall so that we can get as many people natural light as we can. And the actual location and schematic is still forthcoming, but the contract will be coming to you to get that work done. And that leaves us with the two buildings north of here, 1801 and 1805, mm-hmm. and that are currently being used by particularly 1801 that we may be able to facilitate moving here. And if we are, then that frees that building up, and then mm-hmm. we'll decide who's going to go in there, and that's going to be the work of the architect engineer that we're going to bring on board.
Okay.
All right?
Oh, wow.
Cool. Yeah. That will also include redoing our lobby here, so it's not quite so barriers. Oh, we are actually doing this room. Yes. Well, we're not redoing the room. What we're going to do.
This room again?
The force account's going to fix the ramp and the height of these desks. So we're going to come up with the floor. And we've got the architect on board who's doing the plans or doing a couple of options. But the ramp's going to come up this side so that we don't need to have this high of a table. It'll be like a regular desk height. I should have done this years ago, but it didn't bubble up as something, and I just want to get it done.
I see.
For the 5 feet commissioners.
No, I'm not exactly a towering guy.
All right, thank you guys.
Let me just throw one question out because you know you have people with finance backgrounds armed with calculators, mm-hmm. and you wind up with weird things. But I just had a question because I was going back to the 80 OPI units that are being redone. These are interiors only, right? Because we've already done the envelope on them. Is that correct? So the roofs and the outsides have been done.
Not all of the properties have had exterior.
We still have some different projects exterior-wise. We're not 100% done.
Oh,
what
okay.
you're asking is...
No, those 80 units that mm-hmm. we're talking about here, I'm assuming, because I think it says that they're interiors only...
Yeah.
And so I looked at that and said, whoa, now that's $72,000 a unit. Mm-hmm. And then we're going into this thing, which looks just dreadful. And I mean, this thing really looks like a reclamation project. Mm. And we are doing that for $83,000 a unit.
Both of which would be a bargain.
So now, but I'm
and I think it's a, no. I think your point is really well taken, because it's important to get used to what it really costs. Mm-hmm. And if you have the average RAD voucher in the country, including Kansas City and Dallas, funding over 120 per unit for the money that they're restoring, these are actually not as bad as what they're
doing. I look at this one $500,000, six units. We're going from unusable to like top quality condition.
Yeah.
That's a definite.
It's a bargain.
That is a bargain.
It's hard, and I'm glad you brought it up, because it's hard to tell the world.
That's a bargain.
It's hard to convince the world, and it's such a bargain compared to new.
What my question is really the $72,000 for interior only versus the $83,000 a unit for the whole shebang. So that just gets me wondering if, I'm just wondering what is making that ratio like it is. Why are those interiors of the 80 OPI units so expensive relatively? And I'm not saying that in the abstract they're expensive.
And some are,
right?
And some aren't.
I'm just doing the comparison between these numbers right here. What I'm
and some
at.
Are and some aren't with OPI. OPI are heavily used units, and sometimes there's more related systems work in the building. One of the things we didn't do with the envelope is fix some of the interior systems, these sewer lines and things that cause a lot of trouble. So depending on the unit, it can be very expensive or not. Mm-hmm. And these are ballparked based on what our experience is, I believe, over the past couple of years.
That is correct.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Depends on the work in the unit would be the only answer. It's much easier to take if you're taking the whole the building off and you say, this is what we're going to cost per unit, but if you don't know what the units are yet, which is the case of OPI, until they become vacant, then they're estimating based on what the history is rather than based on what the actual knowledge is.
Okay, so we should be expecting positive variances there.
Well, we always have positive variances in this area. Yeah. All right. Any other questions?
Thank you.
So we have one other presentation. I don't know if you want to take a break now.
No, that was a very good job. Thank you very much. I mean,
thank you, Commissioner.
This is actually really cool, because these presentations all are very clear, easy to understand, making sense, and we appreciate it for our feeble minds here.
Thank you. And you know what you realize is how much coordination it takes to do something that seems simple, but it's really complicated.
Oh, we know.
Just to do the budget, to figure out what projects, what it costs, how they go together, how to buy materials, because you'll see that several times when we do the line items. Thank you. Thank you all. So we wanted to go over our project list. So Phil Neville, Deputy Executive Director of Real Estate Development, is going to walk us through what we're currently budgeting in the next year. And again, we may not expend all these funds next year, but we want to make the commitment that they're there.
Yeah.
Phil, take it.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Commission, of course, I'm Phil Neville, and we're here to talk about the Office of Real Estate Development capital projects, which should be moved along in front of you there. Momentarily. The first one we wanted to mention is the Avi Vista project. Is that going to come up on the screen for them?
I think you've got to hit, I can hit it from up here, but
okay,
if you
I got to hit
the
it.
Arrow button forward, you can
I do. So the first project is Avi Vista. That's a project you already know about that's already 100% occupied. And the story there is that we haven't drawn all the money. Bridget's been tracking the funding. We still have 1.4 million that we haven't spent yet. They could draw part of that between now and June 30th, but our guess is that most of it will be drawn in the new fiscal year. So that's an old project, and some of you went to the grand opening. The second project on our list is 94th and International. And that project, you know, we already purchased a couple years ago the site, and we're partnering with Axville Gospel Church and the related companies. And again, you knew about this project from that time. There's 59 rental units being built there. Okay, should we go back and forth? All right. Whoops. There we go. and then we can come back to the list.
Well, this one covers the list as well.
This has the list right on.
Yeah.
Thank you. So essentially, 94th and International, the work there has begun, but primarily we've been working on the removing toxics from all the buildings along International. And all but one of the buildings are now down, so they've been doing the demolition. One more building we're working on to demolish, and then all that has to be hauled away, and some of it is classified as toxic, so it has to be moved to specialized dumps and so forth. So then we'll begin to get into the ground and start actual what we call construction. So that project is moving forward. It's not going to be completed for another year. The Alvin Groom EC Court project is an older project that's been under a HUD program, and the city has made a loan in the past. It's a troubled project. We've discussed this with you briefly in closed session. The proposal is that we would buy the site to assist with a renovation that would be done by certain partners that aren't yet in the game. Right now, the property is still owned by the original partnership, and they're working with HUD, and HUD is pressuring them to do something, or they're going to foreclose on the site. The city also has a loan. They're in default with the city. We've got Bridget and Clint Loftman from our project, from the development side, working on this project. So that's an acquisition. It wouldn't happen unless we cleared the NEPA review. So that's why we haven't asked for formal approval yet, but we're placing that in the budget as a proposed project. We also have on here pictures of Ave Vista that we just talked about. Again, that's the one that's 100% complete. Isn't that beautiful?
Yes. Yeah, that is.
And then on the bottom, you'll see the drawings by Michael Willis Architects of 94th and International. And that's really going to improve that part of town in Far East Oakland. As you know, that bus rapid transit is going to come right through there, and it looks like a stop would be right there at that corner, which would mean people could, from that development who live there, could get into the downtown or in inner East Oakland quickly.
Phil?
Yes.
Excuse me, Chair. What do we got underneath? I haven't been here. I want to go see it. But what do we have down on the first floor? Everything's empty right now because it's brand new?
It's under construction.
It's under the first floor will be commercial?
Yeah,
on the first floor, once we start actually constructing the building, there'll be about 3,500 square feet that'll be retail, and that'll be managed by an entity of Axeful Gospel. The Community Development Corporation will manage that retail space. They assembled the parcel, they bought all the land, and their partner, they brought in Related to do the heavy lifting for on the development side, on the tax credit development. So it's a good team there. The city is also part of that team, by the way, as they often are, providing funding. Brooklyn Basin, that looks very spectacular, doesn't it? You know, the proposal is to redevelop the old Brooklyn Basin site with over 3,000 units of housing and a lot of commercial space. And the deal the city has with the developers, Signature and Zarsan Development, is that two of the parcels that are just off the freeway would be used for affordable housing development. Okay. So Signature has picked Midpen Housing, a very good housing developer here in the Bay Area. They've opened an Oakland office, even though their headquarters were in Foster City. And there's a proposal to build four affordable developments, 465 units total. And the city and the developer have asked us to come in. And again, we've talked to you about this to some degree, but we haven't cleared NEPA yet, so we haven't asked for your formal approval. But we have put this in as a request for our budget for the coming fiscal year. The city bought the land for $23 million, and we're looking at buying half interest for $10 million. So you might say we're getting a bit of a bargain. But they also want us to come in because of the project-based vouchers and other other skills that we can bring and help with the development, make it happen. I will report that the development team with the city involved in MidPen are already beginning to plan the first two phases on that first site. So they're going to go forward with that. There is some bad news. The city was not able to get the state to cut loose with some funds that were held by the Department of Finance that were
more than from some. It was a very large figure.
Over 40 yes. million. And the city is appealing that now. You might say they're appealing it. It's a very strange process, but they're still somewhat hopeful they can get some or all of that money. But the developers feel they can go ahead even if they don't get the money. They'll have to work a lot harder. So we've got Denny Adeneal working with Bridget on that one. So
how many units total for this?
This would be 465 units with
the total
over 3,000, right? And by the way, it was in the news the other day. I didn't alert anyone to it, or I think, Eric, you saw the article. The first phase for market rate is now being planned, and they hope to get that in the ground very quickly.
And so what he means is they received, not just being planned, they got capital. Yeah. They've got the lending to get the construction.
Yeah, they got some entitlements for it, and they believe they put the money together. So they
first market rate.
They will probably start that market rate phase before we start, because our development needs to assemble several layers of money, including ours, and we have to clear NEPA to do that. But that's very exciting. As you can see, that will really change that part of town. For any of you that were able to come, Marlene maybe was there, to the groundbreaking sort of announcement, whatever they called that. It's a fabulous place to stand there next to the water and look at the downtown and look at the hills and think what could happen there.
So, Phil, our investment in that project of $10 million then, that would be going toward half of the interest in the land. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Okay. And now just because I mean I understand that this is our classic operation, which is to own the land and leverage into the project. But now in this particular case, I'm just trying to understand, get my head around the benefit that is going to come to the world around us from us investing that $10 million.
Well, the land is really worth about twice that.
Yeah, no,
and that
I
was less appraisal.
That.
But what I'd like to do is hold off any conversations into closed session
That's
because
fine.
It's a
okay,
real
good.
Estate transaction.
Thank you. So again, by the way, of the four phases they plan there, one would be for seniors, the other three for family.
Nice.
And then on the first parcel, they would actually develop a senior project and a family project at the same time. So they're working really hard, and we're meeting with them, even though we haven't made the formal commitment yet.
Considering that this project had no affordable housing in it at the beginning, this is really a huge win.
It's a huge win,
for the
really,
city of Oakland,
for the affordable housing community.
Yes, it is.
And I'm not sure if it's their first project, but MidPen is very talented, and I think we're happy to have them come into Oakland. And expand the skill set we have here to work on these. We really are behind on how many affordable units we've been able to build, and this would really, really, really help us. The next project on our list is the Lion Creek Crossings offsite. It's a Hope 6 project that we all know is Foothill. We're looking at the option. The Housing Authority has the first option and right of refusal on this project. And Bridget's leading a team that's been studying this along with our attorney, Michelle Brewer, and some financial advisors from CSG, and our asset management team with Anna. Everybody's been involved in trying to figure out how we could buy this. And we've placed up a sort of a high estimate on what it would cost us to buy this property that cost about $17 million to build some years ago. And we'd like to buy it in the coming year. We have an option. We're not ready to come to you with specifics on this. We're negotiating with the investor. And in this case, we may need to come to you in closed session, to be frank, to talk about the details. But we want to put a placeholder in the budget.
Mm-hmm. But you said seven. I'm sorry, I'm not.
Yeah, it cost $17 million to build when it was when we bought into it in 2005, and it's a beautiful development in many ways, but it will need some more work too. And it's been in the tax credit program now for 10 years, and we have an early option is what we have. So we want to get in there early and take this one over. And then probably down the line, we would figure out a rehabilitation strategy.
So what are we budgeting for that?
That's the $2 million figure is what
we're... That's the $2 million.
Yes. Okay. And we felt that would be spent in the next fiscal year.
I see.
So across the street from 1540 Harrison, or the backside, which is, 1540 Webster, our Section 8 office building. Its backside is right up the street here on Harrison, 1535 Harrison. Across the street from that is a big lot we own at 15th and Harrison. We're 15th kind of T-bones into Harrison there. There were three lots that were assembled. It's a beautiful parking lot that we rent and make some money off of, but it's a beautiful development site. And we've been working on that, and we would like $1 million to do all the pre-development work. That would include hiring all the architecture and engineering team that would be working on the environmental issues there and planning what we would build. We'll need more money eventually to put that project up, but this would get us through the next fiscal year. So once again, Bridget is working in this case with Denny on this project, Denny Adania, and we think it's a very exciting site to work on. This downtown neighborhood's become very popular. We're so close to BART, and again, we would look for affordable housing with retail commercial space on the first floor. This is the one Eric would secretly like Trader Joe's to move into, but
Trader Joe's.
We have really not talked to them because we're not far enough along, but we would try to do something that the neighborhood could use there in terms of neighborhood serving retail.
And Prosperity Place.
Prosperity Place is the project, you know, is 11th and Jackson in partnership with the Bald Sea. That project is now approximately 50% complete. Clint Loftman is working with the developers on that as our partner there, and that's going very well. We don't anticipate needing extra funding. We bought the land. The land was very expensive, and we do not have any loan we're making of that project, but we will, once it's completed, provide project-based vouchers. The neat little thing about that is they're working with a local health care provider to open a dental clinic there, and negotiations are very far along. We hope that'll be coming to Eric for approval in the near future. We thought it was going to come last month, but they're still hammering out a few of the details. So if there's any questions, that's the end of my presentation.
Yeah, I have a question. Where is a property located near Lions Creek Crossing? Is that near the BART?
No, that's actually right. The property we're talking about is across the street from the Eastmont Mall. It's a blue and white building.
Okay.
You probably have heard of it called Foothill Family Apartments.
It was built as part of the Lion Creek Crossing Hope 6.
We called it Lion Creek because there's 21 public housing units out of the 65 units there. And then Eric was mentioning a little while ago that we put in 11 project-based vouchers when the project wasn't operating in the black like it should have been. It was operating at a deficit. And so it's a very interesting looking project, I think, a nice looking project. It's right next to the Occur Computer Training Center.
It's actually right on both sides. To give you an idea of the units that Phil talked about, we have Ave Vista with 68 units, 94th and International at 59, Avangroom E rooms, if we go ahead with that, is 126, Brooklyn Basin, 465 affordable units, Lion Creek Crossing Offsite, which is, you know, is Foothill Family, 65 units. We're not sure about 15th and Harrison, how many units that would create. And then 71 units at 11th and Jackson Prosperity Place.
Easily over 900 units, maybe close to 1,000.
Yes.
Thank you, Phil. So we have the final budget review. Do you want to take a break or do you want to keep going? We'll go over the tables.
Keep going or take a break? You'd like to what?
I appreciate our staff staying with us as long as they too. Perhaps they also need to
slip. Maybe
they can slip out. You have a harder time, so.
It's on recess or whatever.
All right. I am indifferent, although we might as well slug through unless people really need to run out. All right, so let's roll.
I'll try to be brief. Tracy Stabler, Chief Financial Officer. Good evening. Before I get started, the one thing I'd like to do is introduce you to the budget team. Well, I have tonight Caroline Barnett, Senior Budget Analyst, and Jonathan Young, our Financial Analyst. They are the bones behind this whole budget process. They do a lot of work meeting with each department, each director, and then aggregating all the information to get it in the format of these two budget documents that you're going to review tonight. So my thanks. So what I'd like to do tonight is kind of walk you through the whole budget process, kind of give you an overview of what the financial accounting and the layout of the form is, and then answer any questions you have on the detail. So we have many departments in the Oakland Housing Authority. Tonight you're going to see just the Housing Authority. We exclude OPI and CAHI because they go to their own boards with their budget. What we have are based on the revenue. So we have several groups of revenue. We have what we call our MTW single fund group of revenue. That's going to be our public housing subsidy, our housing choice voucher, other special purpose voucher revenues, and our capital fund revenues. So this big pot of money is what we use to accomplish a large bulk of every service that we give in the Housing Authority. We also have housing revenue, which is the tenants themselves paying their rents and any other type of small charges that we would receive from them, miscellaneous charges, maintenance, et cetera. We also have in that housing revenue, on the OPI side, we pay actually the HAP revenue to them, and that's another source of income. We have miscellaneous other revenue, things that Phil's group will do to generate developer fees or ground leases. The police department will collect some fraud income or some parking citation and other revenues based on the tickets that they issue. And then our last one is we have what we call the internal charges and other revenues, and those are just entries and the ways we move money within the organization to make sure every department can give the services and then account for all the costs that they're going to incur.
So now, Tracy, if the HAP payments to OPI mm-hmm. are included in here,
they're not.
Oh, I thought you said they were.
To OPI, but from OHA. Okay. They're included in OHA's.
Expense,
but not
okay, right. Got it. All right.
This is for all agencies, cool. So I actually say that for when you look at the OPI budget on that
got
board.
It.
Okay. So then, just to kind of walk you through physically what it looks like on the big agency wide budget, the larger one, when you start going down the budget on the revenue side, which is at the top left hand side. You have the tenant revenues that I discussed, and then that is followed by the large MTW single fund, the public housing, the Section 8, and the capital fund grants, and then some of our other grants that FCP is receiving. The next section is some of that miscellaneous and revenues, the fraud income, the developer fees, et cetera. And then finally, the section at the bottom of the revenue is our allocation revenues and our internal transfers. So then that's the revenue section. The next section is expenses. We break them out.
This is actual, what I'm looking at on this slide.
Yes, it is.
Just a sample.
No, that's actual.
Okay. Thank you.
So then for the expense side, we break out all the expenses based on their function. A large piece of it is administrative, which incurs a lot of salary-based expenses and the benefits that go with that, banking, audit, legal fees, et cetera, and then some of our kind of underlying supplies and services such as telephones and computers, et cetera. We also have the next functional area, which is our tenant services and and our maintenance and operations, mostly dedicated to serving our residents, our participants, and maintaining the buildings in which they live. We have the protective service and general services, that is the expenses of the whole police department, their programs. The general services is a lot of fees we pay out to some of our consultants and primarily our insurance costs. And then the final section is our rehab and housing assistance, which is our biggest expense category, of course, by leased housing paying out all the voucher payments to landlords and to the FSS escrow, et cetera. So those functional expenses then have to get broken out. So just to show you where they're at on the agency-wide roll-up is each section has a total. So the total administrative section, we try to code them. A subtotal is a lighter blue, and the total column is, or the total line is a darker blue. So we have the administrative expenses. That's followed by the tenant services, utilities, maintenance, then our general expenses, and then the protective services, followed by housing, assistance payments, and then finally the allocations, which are the expense side of charging the departments to recoup the services that some departments provide. So allocations, our favorite topic. What we try to do is we start with who are the income-generating departments. Those are always going to be our public housing because they receive rents and public housing subsidy, and then leased housing because they receive most of the revenues from HUD for the Housing Choice Voucher and Special Purpose Voucher programs. So as those departments need to be supported, we back up and say, what type of services are they receiving from other departments, and then how can we charge them out? So the most direct departments, you take one step back, is going to be your property operations, your capital improvements, because they work on the buildings, and they work to provide the services directly to tenants. Then we back up another layer and say we're also providing services through the police department, our real estate development department, that kind of give a more broad overview service, but they are still directly involved with providing services directly to our residents. And then finally, our central office cost center, which is the executive office, the finance department, IT, human resources, where we give ancillary services, not directly to our tenants, but we give them to the department to provide those services. So to allocate the expenses, we usually want to start with, on the budget, we start with the right side is the most direct service, and then the ones closest to the description on there is the ones further away from the direct revenue. So starting on the left, you have the central office cost center, followed again by the security, OHAPD, and the real estate development. Then our family, community partnerships, property management, asset management, and the CID, who get closer to providing directly to the residents and to the buildings. And then finally, the public housing themselves, the HAP. The column we're calling non-HAP is the leased housing department that isn't directly the housing assistance. So those two columns kind of combine to be leased housing. And then our non-federal.
What is CID, please?
Is our capital improvements department, William Bailey's group, that actually does a lot of the maintenance and the operational on the buildings and the administrative buildings.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. So just a little overview of the allocation. We start with the central office, and those departments each have a different way of allocating based on the services they provide. And you know, the IT department will do it on the number of devices, the HR department will do it on the training and the services they give each department, etc. So we take our services and the cost of those and allocate them to every other department. And then the next stage is the services of the OHAPD and real estate. They take those costs and combine them with their own internal costs, and then they allocate those to the next group, which is the property operations, the internal service centers, and the sites, which is the public housing and the leased housing group. So then the third group is those internal services, property operations, capital improvements, family and community partnerships. And you take they take their allocated costs and add their own internal costs, and then they allocate them downward to the public housing and the leased housing group. And then the final group is the public housing and leased housing, and they basically receive all those costs because they're the ones who have the revenues to pay for them. So they actually receive everything ultimately, but it starts with the cost center and then moves its way down. Okay? So the actual cost allocation, there's two sections. The revenue section, which is account 3655, and we call it allocated overhead fees. And then under that, we've decided we're going to separate out the OHAPD so you can see those costs separately because they're a different tier of revenue. The capital improvements department is not shown here because they're shown just slightly down under account 4430 as direct charges because they work specifically on buildings, so it was more appropriate to directly charge every time they work on a building to that. If they work at Lockwood, they'll charge Lockwood. If they work at Peralta, et cetera. And then finally, the allocation section is at the very end of this whole roll-up document, and it's the goes in line with the central office, followed by property management, security, and CID. So those are the charge side of the allocations. Okay. And then the last thing I wanted to show you is what the final document at the end that you're usually most concerned with is the roll-up to total revenue, the total expenses, and then how our performance is expected to be based on the revenues we're bringing in. And then from there, we take out the capital outlay, which is all the improvements and renovations that Mark and William and Anna Kay were talking about. And then this year, as you recall, we received permission from you as the board to pre-fund our OPEB plan. And so we wanted to show our anticipated expenditures to pre-fund that during the year. And so we're putting it down here. And as you can see, all of our plans for particularly the capital has exceeded the revenue that we're bringing in this year. So we are showing that that's going to be a use of prior MTW reserves that we have not yet spent.
Tracy, OPED, please.
Is other employee benefits, the health care, retiree health care plan. It's
That's
other post-employment
CalPERS.
Benefits, yeah.
Oh, CalPERS, okay.
Well, CalPERS is the pension, and this is the other post-employment benefits, which is the health care piece of it. It's a separate plan.
Yeah.
We funded our health, our pension plan prior to the GASB 68 implementation last year, and this is to address this plan, which will have the same type of accounting change in about 3 years.
So we hope to do this for the next, I think, 3 years?
Three years, yes.
Yeah, and it'll get it'll make us, so rather than 3 years us owing a bunch of money and showing a huge deficit, it will show we paid in and we're actually at a good threshold. The last one is the net reserve deficit over, where do we get 350,860.
The 350,000 is actual revenue over expenditures in the non-federal account. So since we don't want to use the non-federal monies for things that an MTW activity is allowed to do, that isn't being used to fund any of the capital or except their own department.
Yeah, except that one property.
Exactly.
Yeah, the state six.
But so this is money.
This is excess revenue, so we hold it in a non-federal account so it doesn't mingle with HUD funds in any way, and that shows an input this year of $350,860.
I see.
Is there two separate accounts of reserves then? If this is a non-federal reserve, is there also a different one?
Well, the MTW transfers are MTW HUD funds, designated funds for specific purposes, which include our renovation development activities, police services, all those are eligible activities. We use the transfers in, actually.
That's what this is. It says transfer in from reserves.
Yeah, so those are available HUD funds that we have in reserve from prior years. And it's how we get our development done so we don't spend, if we have available HAP funds that haven't been used for HAP, we can use them for other things. And we amass them over years. And then like we did the first group of properties that we built, that we had the retreat and we talked about how to spend them. We then just did that again with the list. what it takes is several years to build them up, and then this is how we expend them. If you look at the large table, I don't know if you're there, but at the bottom of the large table, you can see we're actually booking the deficit that we're going to use MTW funds for in this budget mostly under public housing properties and the investment there, because if you remember, we're doing $19 million there and then an operational deficit, and then the rest under development, which is 10.
Could you direct me to the page?
It's the last page of the large table at the very bottom.
You may recall during the presentation of our comprehensive annual financial report back in January, or I believe it was February, the revenues over expenses, although our budget may have been for something smaller, I think we had budgeted to have a $24 million deficit, but our CAFR shows that we actually had I believe $30 million surplus, and that's where the reserves come from, because those were unspent HUD or MTW monies that we put aside, and they were sitting in the cash account waiting for us to spend this capital. So,
and this will look similar if we don't spend the money next year. It'll be the same. Okay. We'll just keep rolling the money forward until it gets expended on the projects. All right.
One of the things we were trying to do with the budget this year is HUD is now getting ready to change the process where they're going to keep all of our cash, and we're afraid that there is some exposure to, if Congress wanted to take an action, they could claw back or offset it and take the money back permanently. So one of the rules they've told us is that we can show commitments and obligations to spend the money, and that will safe harbor it. So we're trying to adopt a budget that shows the plan that we have for these monies and that we're going to be spending them. Mm-hmm.
Sounds good.
So just add a couple questions.
Yes, please.
I did have some questions, if I may.
Yes,
did
you I? May.
Oh, yeah.
That's mainly on this sheet.
We're all here and eager to answer whatever we can, we can.
It's pretty much as questions to help you understand how to put together.
Mm-hmm.
On the first page, fraud recovery, what is that number made of?
That's
fraud
a
fraud recovery.
Fraud recovery. Chief, do you want to answer that? Or
that's Carol.
$350,000. That's a lot of money.
Again, Carol DePlessis, Chief of Police. Well, the fraud recovery is it's funds that the police department and the lease housing department mainly collects from investigation for those who violate the program, the Section 8 program, or in some cases public housing or OPI. We will prosecute residents in some cases depending on the extent of the violation, and in most cases what we do is we just assign repayment agreements to them and bring the money back into the program.
And what is it? What do you
It's recouping housing assistance payments.
Housing assistance payments. Okay.
Yeah. We've got to take advantage of the straightening out.
Okay.
Is that it?
Thank you, Chief. And then my other question, and again, just clarification, miscellaneous other income, what is that made of?
Primarily, that is, again, the police department, where they issue parking citations, and they have arrangements with the city of Englewood for other income that they generate through writing tickets, et cetera. So.
Okay. I'm just looking at all this. So my other question, miscellaneous tenant income, what
I'm
is
sorry,
that?
Which one is that?
Miscellaneous tenant income. What is that?
That's any tenant income for damages or anything that they would cause that we charge the tenant for that does not involve the rent.
Damages, lockout fees. Okay, just understanding the budget. That's it. Mm-hmm. A couple more. Let's see my other question. Just one second. Okay. bad debt tenant rents?
That's when we write off tenants, it comes before the board, that we're not going to collect anymore. That's bad debt tenant rent write-offs. So what Mark does is book those into his budget so that he knows how many, he anticipates how many he's going to write off in the next year. So when we bring the item, and it'll be about every quarter, if not every 6 months, we've been doing it more regularly, okay, he'll say, and it's included in the 2017 budget. That what he's telling you is that's the line item he's included that he's going to be writing off the bad debts as uncollectible.
The second schedule is a year-over-year comparison, so what that was doing is taking the fiscal 16 approved budget and putting the fiscal 17 budget side-by-side, and you can see how we've changed a lot of them. There's going to be some large variance this year because of the increased activity and family community partnerships.
Okay.
Some of the programs at least housing is going to undertake, so there are some larger variances this year, but it gives you a good comparison.
Okay. Great. Those were all my questions. Yeah, thank you. Very much appreciate it. Thank you.
Yes.
I have a question on this document. Why is there such a big difference in Section 8 income between 2016 and
because we got a 35% increase in the voucher payment standard.
Big difference.
Yes.
That's the money. That's what it means every year. And when I said, and when I was talking about what HUD usually does, is you get your
right
increase, and they don't give you the money till the next year.
Oh,
this
I
is
see
the money. As soon as they gave us this money, it meant that a lot of my problems in doing this budget went away.
Went away.
Yeah. So are you basically getting 2 years worth of money in 2017
no
fiscal?
No, that's every year.
No, it's just that they don't usually give you any of the money
the first year. They usually just give you
some of the money
in the second year,
which is just it's a break in historical precedent.
Yeah, it was really, and I'm going to say it was really Ophelia Beskall, who in the local office fought for HUD to change this because they were so worried about families not being served or us having to anything and
that's
do a
great
bunch of other work. So she mailed in February. She was just before she retired and let us know that we got it, and then we got the letter.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's huge.
They're a good thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Awesome. And then on the third page, this may be fairly minor, but bank fees are about half. And so I'm just wondering if we're using another kind of institution or.
And no, actually, the bank changed how they're charging it. Primarily, we would receive investment income separate and then receive charges for bank fees. And now they take some of the fees out of the investment income. So you're not seeing any investment.
I see. Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Any other?
And then just are we moving towards as much solar as we can?
Not really.
Be absolutely honest.
And here's the reason is it doesn't work. You could have, we have solar at Palo Vista. Mm-hmm. We should probably be talking about where we can put it elsewhere. We tried some different things with the project-based Section 8 mm-hmm. scattered site portfolio, but it was really challenging to do a reverse metering, and how does it benefit residents, which is the source of the income. But we do have it in one of our public housing sites. We really need to figure out how we can make the math work to put it in other sites and where we go about getting the resources. And we haven't really thought that through, because we had a deal that we were going to do originally with redevelopment, and they were going to fund us some seed money to try it in a site we have that is up, it's on Webster, but it's north. And it was a multifamily, and we had to sort through a lot of challenges, and we talked to them, and we figured out. But just when we were getting ready to do it, they pulled redevelopment, and the project went away. So we haven't, if you have any sources or ideas, please share them. We would be interested to talk about it. I think it's a greater possibility probably with larger sites than with the small scattered sites. Okay. We had just the economics of it were hard when there's six or seven units.
Yeah, no, I understand.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, question. Sure.
Thank you, and thank you so much for putting this together, Ms. Tracy. So the 35% increase, did we do these numbers before we got that? That's why they're on the low end? Because one of the first things that I noticed was that we dropped a lot as far as the variances are actually on the underside versus that we're spending more money. And I'll identify some of the questions that I have, but is that the reason why some of our numbers are low?
Because I would think not on the variance of expenses. On the income is where it changed.
On the income.
Yeah, and then we did make some, you know, for example, if there's some of the major moves, and we can walk through some of them, have to do with the happen, where it moves in the expense side.
Okay.
And some of it is just budgeting different lines, which Tracy can go over any of the questions on them.
Thank you, then. Well, then, it looks like we're really tightening up on some of our items.
We're getting
better.
And we're
spending less, and I really noticed that.
Well, some of it is that we have a tighter, that when we do the budget, we base it on more knowledge. So we look at last year's, and if we can roll up 6 months, and I'm hoping we can get even more accurate in terms of what we're forecasting based on historical. You know, couple years ago, not that long ago, we didn't have history to really pull from that was meaningful because it wasn't being booked in a way that you could really rely on it and draw that. We've come a long, long way from where we were 5 years ago, 10 years ago.
So you're saying that the budget is a little bit more accurate towards what our actual expenses
yeah.
is?
Yes, because we have more history to draw from,
excellent,
so we can project
excellent.
Better.
Great. So, and then my first question would be, it looks like we're going to be spending more on administrative overtime, a 76% increase, and I know Director Johnson, mm-hmm. you're always saying, no, we're going to keep the overtime down.
We do keep overtime down. Do you want to?
Last year, we had
compared to what it used to be, believe me. Yeah, well, Tracy, you know the answer.
Budgeted temporary labor so that Leased Housing could go through their big lease up.
Into the mic, I don't know if they can hear.
Temporary labor, mm-hmm. we elected to do overtime.
Okay.
Michelle's group elected.
So oh, really?
That's primarily for the Leased Housing to do their outreach to do the lease up.
That's good.
Mm-hmm. So we're switching. So we're switching from hiring temporary workers to actually.
We don't hire many temporary unless they're backfilling employees that are on leave. So in terms
okay.
of that's why we hire very few temps other than that. In fact, I don't even think we have a temp on board other than someone who's backfilling someone who's on an extended leave.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. And how about page 3 on the translation services? We're going up 134%.
Yeah.
What would be the reason behind that?
Some of it is the cost of the language line and trying to more effectively use that. We also, by the way, are talking about increasing our bilingual pay. In the union table because we want to have our employees receive more. They spend a lot of time. Some of them don't want to do it because we don't pay them enough, honestly.
Mm.
There's a lot of language services that we need to improve on would be the answer to why there's more money.
Okay. That's very excellent.
Written and we do the phone line on the phone.
Are we including additional languages now? I know Spanish and English is probably...
Well, the language line will do almost any language you can think of.
Oh.
That's the advantage of it.
Okay.
And then we have staff who are designated who have taken a test and they get an extra pay enhancement, and we want to try and make that more attractive.
Excellent. Okay. On page 4, we have... I think this is a good thing because you know who I am, is the 80% increase on the civic engagement activities. So I'm hoping, I mean, that's going to be the expansive of the SCP program, correct? You're going to do
I'm going to have
more?
To, some of that I think could be some jobs plus cost, but I'm not sure.
Oh.
Yeah, so we got more money.
Okay.
So we put it in different places. But one of the big aspects of Jobs Plus is building community and some of the publications related to it, but also hiring community coaches, residents who live in the community to help with lifting up the families and getting them and assessing them and letting them know what they need. It's a community-based program, and the community coaches are an essential part. So they're in here. I'm not sure if Lenny is here to answer.
Yeah,
Ms.
Yes. Williams, sir. So. She's just going to concur, probably, right?
No, she won't. She'll correct me. That's what.
She'll correct
that's the role.
You. Thank you. The 80% increase on page 4.
Are you looking at the one that we had sitting out for you to?
Yeah, which one are you watching?
Oh, so you're saying this is wrong? Let me check it out.
Because page 4 is actually all maintenance, which is why I don't see it either.
Oh, let me see. Well, this is under 4230004.
That helps. let's look that. That's the previous page in the rule.
Yeah, we're showing the same amount.
80% increase?
No. The same amount being spent in 16 and
250 and 250.
So that's a correction that I need to make then.
Yeah, are you looking at the new handout?
No, okay, I'm not. Oh,
yeah, that's okay.
And I don't know what the difference between the new handout and the old handout.
The fiscal year 2016, mm-hmm. this year's budget numbers were the wrong version.
Okay.
So it wasn't the one that the board
had
passed.
So you're saying 2016 we spent 250.
Yeah, and we budgeted 250. Yes.
Okay. All right, great. That's a good clarification to make. Thank you. So then all this information.
Although I would say tenant services is increasing by 23% because of the increases of, you know, the activities that we need to enter the
report. Okay. All right. So then I'm not sure whether I don't know what the differences are between the one that you gave us and one that you.
There's no difference in the 2017 budget amount.
Okay.
In terms of the 2016 budget, the figures were inaccurate, and we had to correct them over the weekend, and that changes the variance report.
Is it significant to where I'm looking at something?
It makes no difference in the fiscal year 2017 budget. It's only the old year.
I just love to see the
differences. It's just the variances. So if you're looking at year-over-year changes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let me look at, just out of curiosity, 4630, which is that we're going to spend a lot less in 2016 for gas. So I was just curious about that, but it might have been corrected now, right?
4630,
which is
gasoline, is actually a reduction of 41%. And a good chunk of that is getting a more energy efficient fleet, including
Very
the electric
good.
Gems that Mark has ordered over the years that you've approved.
That is excellent.
Yeah.
Very good.
And Priuses. You've approved both of those.
So replacing the older, less efficient cars.
Yes.
And that even includes some of the old trucks that have been recently approved.
Well, this is where it really shows up well.
Yeah.
And I think that's it. I'm just totally still on a big learning curve.
We all are, to be honest with you. It's a complicated budget, and this is the big chunk of it. If we include CAHI, it's a very large agency.
Yes.
And we move a lot of money. The thing to remember is most of our money has very tight strings and can only be used for certain things.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you, Tracy.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I just have one. $35 million transfer in on the, reserves, yeah. That's not newly obligated. Right, for the $35 million. I mean, a lot of that was previously obligated.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I got it.
Those are projects you've already approved. Or identified in close.
Yeah,
session.
I just wanted to clarify that. You know, make sure I wasn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. That's right. We're still going on with our meeting, aren't we?
Are we done with the budget? First, I want to just take the opportunity to thank the level of professionalism of the staff to pull this together. It's amazing to me how challenging a budget can be and how easy they're making it and how fluid they are with changes, even with the 2016 errors. I mean, that's not in this budget. It was just rolling in the wrong table. But the real work is starting at the site level, and it starts in December, and the prep and the meetings, and you end up here. It's not an easy process, and I'm hoping that what we give you is a budget that reflects your policy direction and your ideological direction for this agency, because that's the goal.
Yes.
And I think that they work very hard to do that during the year and make the right decisions, and I'm grateful for the great support I get from my staff.
Yes.
And I would like to second that, Eric, because one of the advantages of having been here a long time is I was here in the dark days of finance. So I can really see the changes, and they're just astonishing. I mean, this is really cool. I mean, this is a real high-end, financially managed mm-hmm. business, in my opinion. I mean, it's getting every year you can see the movement coming forward. Things are coming out faster. Mm-hmm. The graphics are better. I mean, but that's
right.
Important.
It is important.
Because that's the ability to communicate efficiency. So thank you for a nice job.
Yeah. All right. Thank you all.
Thank you,
all right, cool.
Very clear.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So
there's no action. This will then reappear in old business on your June 20 whatever meeting. Or May, sorry, the May regular meeting for your consideration. I will put it under old business or older continuing business. Okay.
And I believe we have no people wishing to address the commission.
We don't.
If we do.
No speaker cards.
Now, forever hold your peace. All right. So then we can roll on to the written communications.
Written communications. The monthly report is attached. We're available for any questions. And for my report, the only thing I have this meeting is just to remind everyone of Owner Appreciation Day. Thank the Leased Housing Department and Michelle for putting this on for our owners. It's sure going to be an interesting day. We're going to hopefully get a good turnout. We're going to talk a lot about things like how you raise rents under the Section 8 program and also the owner incentives, including our RFQs. And I hope we get a good turnout. It'll be in this room on Saturday, right? Or is it next door? Oh, it's in the new building next door. Yeah, but you can just park downstairs and run around. So if you want to show up, I'll be there in the morning, and they'll be here most of the day. And that's all I have.
All right. Do we have any reports from commission committees?
Yes. This is Janie, chair for the Special Needs Committee. And truthfully, staff was very kind enough to share the fruits of our labor through this particular meeting. When you hear of the CalWORKs families extending their subsidies, that's the special need committees. When you hear about foster age transition youth, our attempt to help house them more successfully, that's the special needs committee, and you'll be the SRO piece. And I mean, we're doing it as we go along, and I'm just so excited. And thank you, Director, for just breaking the bar, and truly. It's like the affordable housing was stuck in a wheel, and this is the oil. The special committee is the oil that is making this spin a little bit better, and I'm excited.
No, yeah, because we can see the stuff
that's coming.
And the ideas and input of that committee has been priceless and changed the way we do business.
It's already popping up in the plan, and this is really cool.
Thank you.
Excellent. So do we have any announcements by commissioners?
Will we be, the educational committee will be meeting soon?
No, go ahead.
Later, yeah.
Later on?
Go ahead, Director.
It'll be during the summer break. Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
All right, then.
That's not a committee. That's actually a separate board.
Right. That's a separate board, right.
Thank you, Director
Jones.
And you will be having meetings of both OPI and CAHI. I believe CAHI is tomorrow. They will have their portions of the budget approved at those meetings, as well as financial reports.
So
OPI is tentatively scheduled for the 8th of June, right? Yeah.
So are we now tired enough to
to take a motion to adjourn?
I will entertain that motion.
Okay. It's been moved.
And seconded by Commissioner Montgomery.
And seconded. We are hereby adjourned.
Thank you all.
May everyone have a wonderful evening.
Thank you, staff.